I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. We've been Disney fans our entire lives. And now, as childless adults, we're undertaking a journey through the media that shaped our lives.
Trying to find out if what made them special is still there.
We are Rewatching the Magic.
Hey, Kiki.
Hey, Tuesday.
We're doing episode 2.
Woohoo!
So, by this point, episode 1's already out when we're recording this, so I'm kind of excited about all of this. How are you?
I'm doing great. This has been super fun. The feedback we've already gotten has been very positive, so that's one hurdle we've jumped.
Yes, people actually like hearing our voices. People actually like hearing us talk about stuff. So let's do that. Let's talk more stuff.
Talking more stuff.
So,
what a novel concept.
Frozen 2 just came out. That's giving you an idea when we're recording this. And before we started, you said you haven't seen the movie yet.
I haven't gotten to see the movie yet.
Yeah,
my town is so small.
How small is it?
Little bit of a delay there, but my town is so small that our one movie theater, it has forgotten that it is a movie theater. I'm not entirely sure what they think they're doing over there, like underwater macrame or something, perhaps, but they definitely do not think they are running a movie theater. The last couple of times I've been, of the last 4 times I've been, on 3 of those occasions, they have started the wrong film. And the 4th was, we went and tried to see Rogue One when it came out, and the projector bulb was dying, and you could not see anything basically on the screen. It was so dark. And I went out and I told the manager, your projector bulb is dying and we can't really see anything. And the response from the manager at the time was, yeah, but it's such a hassle to change bulbs, so we just wait until they explode. And so I dressed in full Star Wars outfit, which I made myself, walked out of a Star Wars movie because my theater sucked. So what we have to do is we have to drive an hour to the next nearest small town with a theater and go see it in their theater instead, because their theater actually remembers what they're doing. So seeing movies in theaters is becoming rarer and rarer for me these days, unfortunately. So yes, Frozen 2, we have not gotten to make the trip yet to see, but hopefully we will, as we're coming up on the Thanksgiving holiday as we record this. So perhaps during the holidays we shall go see a movie.
So yeah, I did see it mostly because spoilers are everywhere, and I want to avoid the spoilers. So I saw Frozen 2 last night, and I generally enjoyed it. I think it's my non-spoiler review is I think it's better than the first movie.
Ooh,
I think it's
high praise.
Yes, high praise. I think it's better than the first movie. If you liked the first Frozen, you'll love this movie. If you didn't care for the first Frozen movie, you will like this movie.
Oh, well, even higher praise.
There has been Frozen pushback, and I don't know if it's because they generally dislike the movie, or if it's just pushback because it's popular.
I think it's pushback because Let It Go was absolutely inescapable for like a year and a half there.
I feel sorry for colleagues of ours with young children who had to listen to that song every day for the last 6 years.
Yeah. It's a good song, but wow.
I love Idina Menzel, but you know.
Oh, Idina Menzel is amazing. Like, no hate at all. But if you hear anything ad nauseum like that, I think it's going to become
The new song Into the Unknown doesn't quite get to where Let It Go is, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, I've heard that, and it was not to me as – that's what made me worried about the movie. So I'm glad that people are saying that they like the movie. You're not my first friend to tell me that the movie is really good. Everybody I know that has seen it absolutely says that it is wonderful and excellent and worth going to see. But just hearing that song as they were pushing for the movie, they played it on like Dancing with the Stars and a bunch of other, you know, Disney owned things. And I was underwhelmed to say the least. So
yeah, how about it? If you do go see it, stay. There is a post-credit scene.
Here's a fun fact about me. I never leave a theater until they bring the lights back up at the end. I don't care if there is no post-credit scene. I watch the credits.
They have families. They deserve to be recognized.
Yeah, and I'm actually, you know, enough of a filmmaking nerd that I recognize a lot of behind-the-scenes names, and some of them are frequently nice surprises. The thing is that with the Marvel movies now, people have stopped giving me dirty looks for staying once the credits start, because I would always get people who would just come along and helpfully say, you know the movie is over, right? And I'd be like, I'm watching the credits. And that stopped for a while, but now that people know they can go online and be like, is there a post-credit sequence to any movie, people now try to helpfully tell me, you know there's nothing after the credits. And I'm like, I'm watching the credits.
It's part of the movie and it's part of that experience.
Something about the theatrical experience. So, speaking of theatrical experiences, what are we talking about today?
We are talking about the 1991 movie Beauty and the Beast.
Woohoo!
We can talk a lot about this movie. Again, this is one of those movies like we were talking about with Little Mermaid that has been in various stages of development at Disney for decades. We can talk about, again, this was one of the first to become a full Broadway musical. And this is the big one to me, the first animated movie to ever be nominated for the Best Picture Oscar.
Yeah. And in fact, they changed the rules because they didn't want that happening again. And that's why we now have the best animated feature category or whatever in the Oscars, because they didn't want the animated trash fighting with their lofty live action films. Boo. Well, bad choice, Oscars.
So again, this one has a lot of history behind it. Originally, and then I guess this is the big story here. The big talking point that I want to make is this was not supposed to be a musical originally. This was going to be a straight film, no songs, no singing. And then The Little Mermaid became the big hit that year in 89. And Disney's like, we need to get Ashman and Mayer back. We need to get these guys back and give us another hit. Obviously, it wasn't going to happen with Rescuers because that was already at least partway through production by the time Mermaid came out. So they can go to let's make Beauty and the Beast musical. Howard Ashman, Alan Menken, let's get him back and make some songs. And one thing I did notice, which I never noticed previously, is Howard Ashman, as soon as when the credits roll on the end of the movie, Howard Ashman is like listed as the executive producer for this film.
Yeah, and remember we talked about last time that he actually took over some producing on Little Mermaid. So he had done producing for Little Mermaid, and I was watching a documentary on Disney Plus about the making of the movie last night in preparation for this, and once they decided that it was going to have music and they decided that they were going to use Ashman and Menken again, apparently Jeffrey Katzenberg just, like, cornered, literally, like, just walked up to Howard Ashman and was like, you're not leaving this room until you agree to produce the movie. And Ashman said, okay, and he ended up being a producer on the movie, and at least for, you know, the start of the movie, he was kind of there. The interesting thing that I saw in that documentary was that they basically scrapped a good 6 months to a year of work on this, where they had already storyboarded it and started doing some of the early animation. They had a script, you know, little animatics and stuff. And somebody just kind of looked at it and went, this is not working.
The film actually ended up changing directors because of that.
Yeah, they changed directors. They brought in new directors that had not done a feature before. Had done something for the park in Florida. They had done a little animated something for some attraction at Disney World, and they brought them in and were basically like, you get 6 months to turn this around, and if you do, we'll name you the directors. If you don't, you're gone. But the interesting thing is that when they did the kind of first draft of the movie without the music, one of the animators, I think it was, in the documentary said that it was a movie about a girl who keeps coming to dinner and refusing a request to get married. Absolutely the most boring thing.
To be fair, that is the original story.
It is. And yeah, if you've read kind of any of the early takes on the Beauty and the Beast story, that is absolutely kind of what happens.
Doesn't make a quite compelling movie. And there was really, no enchanted objects like it was in the final film.
Well, the interesting thing is it was one of the few times Disney was kind of sticking to the story, which is not really their forte.
Mm-hmm.
As we discussed with Little Mermaid, they need to change all the things to
break
make
it down to its bare components and rebuild something new.
And so, you know, they came up with that. I was also watching a thing that I really recommend everyone watch if you have access to Disney Plus. There is an extra feature alongside Beauty and the Beast on there that is a 25th anniversary celebration they did of Alan Menken. And they brought in several composers of other Disney movies that you will be familiar with to talk to Alan Menken about, like, what was his process, what was it like working with Howard Ashman, things like that. And it's adorable because three of the four of them are roughly our age, and they are absolutely the most goofy nerds about talking with Alan Menken about this. And the one that is not is Stephen Schwartz, because he knew Alan Menken. And after Howard Ashman's death, Menken said, hey, can you you want to come write a Disney movie with me? And the other three, though, are the couple who is the writing team behind Frozen. They were there and talking about how Menken's music, and specifically, you know, Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast, made them want to become writers for Disney. And then the fourth one was Lin-Manuel Miranda. And Lin-Manuel, get you somebody who looks at you the way Lin-Manuel Miranda looks at everything in the world. Man is a ball of joy floating through the universe.
And then Lin-Manuel ended up working with Disney on some movies. I mean,
yeah, all of them had written for Disney. And he talked a little bit about his process for doing Moana and stuff like that. But it was so adorable to watch them. And what they brought up, and it was something I noticed in there, is that this is really the first time Disney becomes a Broadway musical. And I think that this is why it was the first. I'm not sure if it was the first, but it was definitely the first I was aware of a Disney movie transitioning to stage. And this one, they were able to do it with almost no changes, really. I mean, they added a couple of songs, to pad the runtime for a theater and add a little more character depth. You know, Beast finally gets a song and stuff. Mm-hmm. But as far as just the kind of structure of it, they really didn't need. It's already got the show-stopping number. It's already got all the introductions. It's already got things that are perfect for a dance break. It's, I mean, it is the most you can get writing for Broadway except for the screen. I don't know if that makes sense.
Well,
to
all you
else,
would have but... to do at that point was, you know, figure out the practical effects, and they did that.
Yeah, I think that was probably the most difficult part.
So I think we've talked enough about the behind the scenes and stuff. Do you want to get into the movie proper?
Before we do, I have to tell you one quick thing, which is why this is the most kind of impactful Disney movie for me in one sense. And I kind of teased this a little bit in the last episode, but this was the first Disney movie I ever saw in a theater. Mm-hmm. I would have been 10 years old mm-hmm. at this point. And this was maybe my third or fourth movie that I had ever seen in a theater at all, and it was my first Disney movie I had ever seen in a theater, definitely. I grew up in a very small town, and also in a ultra-conservative religious family. I'm going to say bordering on cult. I do not use that word lightly, but we were very separated from society in a lot of ways. And the one thing you absolutely did not do was you did not go to the movie theater. I still don't know why this was, but something, something, the devil lives there, something, something evil. I don't know. so my childhood was very weird in that sense. But the unfortunate thing is that shortly before this movie came out, my mother got very sick with what would end up being a terminal disease, unfortunately. And because of that, some things in our lives started to change. And one of them was that my parents kind of were like, what's wrong with a movie theater? Let's, you know, break from that kind of teaching and go. The first one I remember seeing in a enclosed theater, you know, like a proper movie theater, was Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which came out a few months before Beauty and the Beast. And then, of course, Beauty and the Beast. So this was really the first time I had seen kind of a grand animated film on a big screen. And got to hear it over the speakers and got to, you know. So as far as a bit of filmmaking, I mean, film going as experience, this is really etched into my brain as just an absolute, you know, watershed moment in my life of like, wow, this is possible, and I love this, and I love movies, and this is my entire life now. yeah.
Yeah, I have no follow-up to that. I have no
follow-up. Yeah, like I said, my childhood was weird, so.
Childhood was weird, but you know, honestly, our adult lives are pretty weird at this, too.
I mean, normal went out the window ages ago, so, all right.
So let's get into the movie, if,
Thank you for sticking with us now to the movie.
And now your feature presentation.
Do you have snacks? Have you gone out to the lobby? Good.
So let's open up the movie with the telling of the Beast's origin story through stained glass. And I think that is a great, beautiful way to tell the story.
Yeah, I mean, props to the animators that came up with that.
Rather than a traditional storybook, you know, I would say like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they kind of, you know, they did that with the storybook in some movies. And, you know, then they went around to mock it with Enchanted. But I really like the stained glass opening. And it has given Disney a lot of merchandise opportunity because so those stained glass things are showing up on. You can get fabric with that on it.
Yeah.
Purses and outfits. Actual stained glass with that, yeah.
So the prince meets the old woman. He rejects.
I just wanted to say, I assume you watched this on Disney Plus for the rewatch.
Yes, yes.
Unlike Beauty and the Beast, this did not seem to be a remaster to me. They
add the new Disney, the more modern Disney logo, so I assume that some touch-ups were made on this.
But when it got into the actual film, I felt like this is what I watched on VHS. Like, this is not a new... Like, Little Mermaid, to me, I was like, wow, this is an HD remaster. Good for them. But this one felt like this was just the straight transfer of the film. It is still beautiful. Do not get me wrong. This movie is absolutely beautiful to this day. But it didn't have that kind of pop that I think Little Mermaid had visually from the HD remaster.
Right.
So I hope they do that to Beauty and the Beast soon.
Well, they did release Beauty and the Beast on Blu-ray not too long ago, right when the remake came out. So I think this is just the best that they're going to get right now.
Mm.
So let's talk about this Enchantress.
Ooh, I got beef with the Enchantress.
The Enchantress is kind of a cruel female dog, I'll say, because I want to keep this PG. Hey, punish the prince for being an a-hole, right? You want to punish the prince for being an a-hole, fine. But to curse the entire staff of the castle is too far.
And also, you really got to remember that if you take all the clues that we've gotten from... you know, various songs and all these other contextual things. This was a child that she did this to.
I have theories on this. Okay, so they say the flower would bloom until his 21st birthday, and there's a song that says they'd been this way for 10 years.
Yeah.
So logically, he'd be an 11-year-old boy. So yes, an 11-year-old boy would be a jerk.
Yeah, and I mean, you're going to do this to a child? Like, really? You're going to do this to a child? And also, the entire staff.
But I have, but there's some notes here, there's some clues even in the film that might suggest otherwise, because when you see the picture of the prince, when the beast tears...
Yeah, he does not seem 11 years old in that.
He's an adult. So, yeah. So my theory is... it's not his 21st... they never say 21st birthday. They say 21st year. So maybe he's just been a beast for 21 years.
Yeah. And maybe he stopped caring for the silverware 10 years in.
if you want to take it like that, maybe everyone in that castle has been cursed for 21 years. And, you know, they just never aged.
Yeah, that is possible. In the live action version of
we're going
the
there already?
Movie, yeah, we're going there already. They really do try to deal with some of these problems that the fans have had with this, like you're doing this to a child. And they did confirm that she did this to a child. They went with the straight up, like he was 11 years old or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or younger. I'm not sure if he was 11.
He was,
but, you know.
Not quite an adult yet.
Yeah, not quite an adult yet. But also, they tried to blame it on, like, bad parenting and everything. But I'm like, still, like, how did the parents get out of the, you know what I mean? Like,
maybe the parents were, again, we have another situation where a prince, but there's no parents, and essentially the staff is raising him.
Yeah, and you know, Mrs. Potts says something in the remake about, like, you know, we deserved it because we stood by and let him be abused. And I'm like, okay, then you deserved it, but why is he a beast? And why is, like, Chip, like, really, Chip deserved it?
Yeah, Chip's a child, a literal child.
The dog deserved it?
That's what always makes me confused about the whole... Prince was a child, because what about Chip? That means Chip would have to have been born already, never been human to begin with, because this kid is like five.
Well, if they stopped, yeah, I mean, it does seem like the servants at least have stopped aging later in the movie, but in a way, I like your theory better. I had never really thought about that he was already an adult and she was like, okay, everything stops now and you get 21 years to be a better person.
Yeah.
And in a way, that makes a lot more sense with what we see in the movie. Because it makes her slightly less awful for what she did, but still pretty awful. I mean, come on.
It's like the reverse Maleficent in a way.
Yeah, this is very much kind of the Enchantress is a villain in my opinion. It may have been like a villain with a more ethical design, but the means do not justify the ends there. Ends do not justify the means there. Yeah. There we go. That's the way that is supposed to go.
Okay, so I think that's all we can really say about that opening scene. So let's get to our first musical number, Belle. We're introduced to Belle and the townsfolk. So we have Belle lamenting about small town life, how she wants more than just living there. Again, something you can attest to for you being living in a small town all your life.
Yeah, if you've ever lived in a small town and did not want to be there, this song is your jam. And this song was my jam as a little kid. Like, wow. Get me out of here as a song. This and the reprise later. Mm-hmm. Just, yeah.
Whew. So we got Belle, voiced by the amazing Paige O'Hara.
Yes.
Talented classic straight stage performer, Broadway performer, amazing voice. Again, like Jodie Benson, you know, you have a classic trained stage actor and Broadway performer performing this character, because you kind of, especially if this is structured like a Broadway musical, you need a Broadway actor to play the lead.
Oh, yeah, and loving it. And I'm glad that Disney is going back to that in a way.
Yeah, at least for Frozen.
Because they went back to it with Frozen, with Idina Menzel and Jonathan Groff. So they've kind of brought that back a little bit, and I think they should, because it worked so well in the early Renaissance films, them having these Broadway people who could act and sing. They sort of kind of halfway did it with Jasmine, you know, where they had the voice as the singing voice as a Broadway, you know.
Yeah.
Same thing in a way with Mulan. But yeah, they kind of went away from that for a while, and I'm glad they're bringing it back in some, at least, you know, in some small amount.
At least in their musical movies.
Yeah, because I really think that that's what it needs. You really need somebody that can act and sing at the same time.
And also acting while singing.
Yeah. I mean, acting while singing is a much more difficult thing than a lot of people give it credit for. You know, I've directed musicals before, and worked with people that it was like their first musical, and maybe they were good singers, but they were like, you know, singers in a band in a bar setting or whatever, and they didn't really have any stage training for that. And it is very difficult to be like, no, this song isn't just like, you're not doing a rock performance here. You're telling a story, and the story doesn't stop when the music starts. And fortunately, Broadway actors kind of understand that already through their training. And it really makes the movies better, in my opinion. They lost a lot when they went away from that practice.
So the song itself, the song Belle, it kind of has, you can see two sides of the coin of resentment here. Belle resents a small town life, but the townsfolk themselves resent back. You know, they don't like that she's daydreaming. They don't like that she's reading. They don't like that she's independent. And she's not, you know, she's not one a girl who just wants to get married and have a family. She wants something more than that. And the town just, they don't understand that.
And this is beautiful. Like, I have no idea where Howard Ashman grew up. Let me just say that. Yeah, he was born in, like, Baltimore and stuff. I mean, he, you know, seems to have spent a lot of time in large towns. I do not know how he nailed small town life kind of as well as he did in this, because there is a lot of pressure in a small town to conform. There is a lot of pressure in a small town not to leave. People who move away are seen as traitors almost. And so anyone who kind of wants to go away from that kind of small little bubble is really smacked down, you know. Oh, so we're not good enough for you? You think you're better than us? You know, what's wrong with this place? What's, you know, what more could you want than is here? You know, your family is here. Your, you know, your roots are here. And the way that the townspeople kind of treat her, it feels, I mean, it's cartoonish in a way, because it's never kind of, not never, but it's rarely that obvious. But at least subtly, that is the feeling. You know, you're the weirdo. You need to stop doing what you're doing and fit in. So, yeah, everything about this song when I first saw it as a kid, and even rewatching it now, I was like, he really nailed the culture of a small insulated town.
Yeah, so the I have down here in my notes. It seems like Belle thinks the town thinks too small, and the town thinks Belle's dreams too big.
Yeah, and honestly, her dreams are kind of slightly less specific than Ariel's were.
She wants to capture in a great white somewhere.
Yeah, but it's very nonspecific. I mean, is adventure just like, you know, I want to do a walk about Europe, or or is it like I want to go fight a dragon kind of adventure, or is it, you know?
And that she just doesn't want what, you know, she doesn't want to just get married and settle down and raise kids. You know, she wants to be appreciated for herself and not for what she, you know, she is beautiful. She is aware that she is beautiful. Everyone is aware that she is beautiful. It's one of those things that comes up throughout the entire movie of men checking her out. You know, I mean, and, you know, even when we get to the castle, the scenes with the knights turning at her. So it's like, she's aware that she's attractive, but she doesn't want to be known as the cute girl. You know, she wants to be seen as something more than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's no wonder that her name means beauty, because her looks have got no parallel.
I mean, it's one of the things that I'm glad that they did expand on in the remake. But
I did like that part of it. A couple of things that happened during the song is, Belle is somehow just treating the bookseller like it's a lending library, which I find awesome.
Well, obviously, you know, they don't have a lot of money because, you know, poor Maurice can't really sell an invention to save her life. So she borrows a book for a day or two and then brings it back and then say, well, I brought it back. You know, technically, like, I could have bought it, returned it, got my money back. So I'll just save it time.
Yeah, but I mean, this seems to be, you know, an old thing with them. So I kind of wonder if, like,
maybe he's doing it because, again,
did this bookseller see Belle as, like, a little girl without a mom and was like, oh, here, sweetie, have a book. And then she just, like,
kept
got
going.
It in her head that, like, if I go there, he will give me books. And he was like, I can't afford to give this child books.
And maybe, 3 days. Well, we don't know how long that they've lived in this town, again, compared to the remake. But maybe he's just, well, you know, he's an old guy and sees a very attractive girl coming into his store.
Yeah, but their relationship seems to have been a lot longer. So he seems very paternal toward her. So I would
maybe think just, that she's maybe been he just doing trusts her. You know, maybe they have that rapport. Life. You know, they have that rapport that he trusts her. You know, like he knows that she's going to return the book, even if she's not paying for it. She's going to return it because she's a good kid.
Yeah, but I do kind of like that because it very very distinctly says bookseller, not. You know, lending library.
So obviously, the story that she's reading at the beginning is Jack and the Beanstalk.
Strangely, a movie that you would have thought that Disney would have done by now, and other companies have done it, but
there was some talk of them doing a Jack and the Beanstalk story. I think it was just going to call either called Beanstalk or Giant or something, and it just never happened. Again, one of those movies that. Got into planning stages and nothing happened. So, obviously, the bookseller gives her the book, and many people for years and years have tried to figure out what story is she talking about, and to me is, she's reading Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, absolutely.
She may not be aware that she's reading her own story, but she's reading her own story.
Yeah, and... The interesting thing is that they brought this up in the little behind the scenes with Alan Menken, because Lin-Manuel does say, I loved how she tells the sheep the entire story of Beauty and the Beast at the beginning, and Alan Menken did kind of confirm that, like, yes, of course, that's what we were doing.
Yeah. So, I'm going to skip ahead here at this point. Kudos to Belle for her awareness of her surroundings.
Okay.
She knows this town so well and knows what everyone is going to do every day that she can just read her book and just know what to do at the right time to avoid bad luck, you know?
Are you ready for story time from Kiki's Weird Life? Because I got
the
one.
The floor is yours,
one.
Kiki. The floor is yours.
Okay, so when I was a kid, after having seen this movie, when I started public school, because crazy religious upbringing, I didn't start public school until later in my life. But especially in like high school. I read constantly. I was the bookish little kid. Belle was me all over. And I would do that. I would do exactly what she did. I would walk down the halls reading my book between classes and just dodging people. And I got so good at it that the bullies decided to make a game out of it to see how well they could trip me up or throw things at me or whatever. And so if I wanted to read my book between classes, the halls of the school became an obstacle course for me. And I was incredibly adept at, dodging things that were thrown at me and, you know, jumping over people's legs that were suddenly thrust out in front of me. Long story short, my high school was, from the very bowels of hell, and, the teachers were actually bigger bullies in general than the students were. So the teachers began to get in on this and goad the students into throwing things at me and, you know, and so it really became like a thing just every day. Like, okay, if I want to finish the next chapter before the bell rings, I've got to go through this weird gauntlet of things thrown at me. So,
it's,
yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned high school because I do have notes about that the town is pretty much high school.
It is very high school. Yeah.
Because. You know, Belle is the girl, is the nerd girl. And then you have, you know, your jock. Your jock slash bully. You're the bully's lackey. You have
and the three cheerleader chicks.
And the cheerleader.
Really
that's in my notes, you know,
yeah.
The cheerleaders. So, speaking of that, do you want to get into Gaston? The introduction of Gaston. Or you have something else to say about that scene?
No, I have one other, because we skipped past probably the most appropriate place to tell this story, but one other high school story relating to Beauty and the Beast.
Go ahead.
I took French in high school, probably because of Beauty and the Beast, and my French teacher hated me. And one day she didn't feel like teaching, and you know, as kids of the 80s and 90s, what happened when the teacher didn't feel like teaching? It was movie day. So she decided we were going to watch Beauty and the Beast, and pick out all the French words, because it was set in France, so educational experience, right? And she said, the first person to write down, like, the first 20 French words they hear gets, like, candy or something. Mm-hmm. And she was up there trying to figure out how the VCR worked with the TV. And I went, done. And she said, what? And I said, I'm done. I've written down the first 20 French words that appear in Beauty and the Beast. And she said, I haven't even started the movie yet. And I said, yes, but these are the first 20 words that show up in Beauty and the Beast. Because what she didn't know was at that point in my life, I literally watched Beauty and the Beast every day. That was, I would come home from school and I would watch Beauty and the Beast. It would be the first thing I would do. And so I really did have the entire movie absolutely memorized at that point. And I still have it about 95% memorized at this age, I noticed last night. So I had just from memory written down, you know, going through Belle and going through the first, you know, like all the dialogue and written them down. And she was like, stop being such a stupid little show off, you little brat. And, you know, yelled at me in front of the whole class. And I was like, look, I'm just going to give you this paper. And if I got it right, you give me candy. And if I got it wrong, give me a zero for the day. Like, be a female dog about it, you know, yeah. Okay? I know I'm right. And so she was like, fine. And she finished and everybody started watching the movie. And, you know, I'm enjoying it because I watched it every day. So, you know, yay. And about 5 or 6 minutes into the movie, she just walked up and dumped candy on my desk silently. And everybody went, aw. And she was like, the second person also gets candy. And everybody started writing down again. So yeah, my French teacher hated me, but I got candy and a 100 for the day in class. Go me.
So let's get into Gaston here. So, I want to talk about this one point. Now, we've seen guns used in many Disney movies, and it's always usually the character either pointing the gun, hitting the trigger, you hear a bang, and then you see someone die. This is the first time I believe we've ever seen a bullet hit somebody, because we see the bullet hit the bird.
Yeah, they are a little bit more gruesome with Gaston than they are in a lot of other movies, especially the modern movies.
But it works for him because it kind of explains the kind of person Gaston is. We don't see any blood of the bird, but it's a clean shot. But you know, maybe it's because it's a non-sentient animal, so it's okay. Maybe.
Well, also I think that, unlike Belle, I think it's there to contrast with the way Belle treats animals, because Philippe, I mean, yeah, he's slightly more sentient, and the sheep, and the footrest dog in the castle. You know, anytime Belle comes up against an animal, with the exception of the wolves, she's very kind and empathetic to it. She immediately kind of, you know, snuggles it. And what, like I said, Belle is me. You know, I'm surprised she didn't try to snuggle the wolves, because I would have tried to snuggle the wolves. You know I would have.
Yeah.
But Gaston, on the other hand, every time he sees an animal, he's like, let me kill that. So it's very much a foreshadowing of how they treat the beast.
Yeah.
You know, Beauty sees the beast and is like, well, he's animalistic, but I like animals. I can relate to them. I still give them empathy. Gaston sees the beast and is like, I need to shoot it and mount it on my wall. So I think that this little bit right here, and then of course the I use antlers in all of my decorating line later, is very much a foreshadowing of what will they do when presented with basically a sentient animal.
Yeah, so this whole scene, we learn everything we need to know about Gaston. He's a hunter, he's a very good-looking guy, but he's also egotistical, and really he only wants Belle because Belle's the prettiest girl in town. That's the only reason he wants her, and not because she's intelligent, not because of anything else she can do, is that she's the best-looking girl, I'm the best-looking guy, so we have to be together because that's how things work in this town.
Yeah, literal trophy wife. Yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, Alan Menken was talking about that this was very much Howard Ashman, that Howard Ashman really shaped a lot about Gaston, not just in the song, but just kind of his general personality, and that this was very much Howard Ashman kind of getting back at the sorts of men who would have bullied him, you know, as a young gay man. That this was very much him sending up all of those manly men bullies that would have been the bane of his existence.
Mm-hmm. So let's get to, before we really get to Gaston proper, we meet LeFou. LeFou. Gaston's lackey / super fan. See, even as a kid, I never got the gay motive that everyone else seemed to have gotten. I just saw him as like he idolizes Gaston because in his mind Gaston is the coolest guy ever, so he's going to be the coolest guy ever's second, his lackey, and that's he's going to maybe get that coolness rub on off to him. You know,
even watching it back as an adult and even knowing the, it still didn't have that ring to it for me. I mean, it definitely does in the live action because they put it there specifically. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, like I said, Howard Ashman was very much shaping these characters as the producer and the songwriter. If he had wanted gay subtext there, it would have been all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, let's just be real clear on that. He was not above putting in some gay subtext in his work, I don't think. And there is a lot of kind of gay pathos with how the story plays out, but LeFou to me never seemed that he was in love with Gaston. He seemed like, I'm going to stand next to the cool kid, because if I stand next to the cool kid, if I make friends with the jock, he'll protect me from other bullies, and I'll seem cooler by default.
Yeah, again, it's more of that high school mentality in this town.
Yeah, very high school. But I really don't, even now, you know, as an adult who can find gay subtext in anything, honestly, I'm just going to say it right out. I still don't see LeFou as being in love with Gaston. I think he just wants to be the best friend of the guy everybody likes because he wants people to kind of like him by default.
The best friend of the coolest kid in school.
Yeah.
So we got Gaston, voiced by Richard White. Excuse me, I can say that again. Richard White, professional opera singer, and it shows in his performance here when he sings his line.
Oh, yeah.
That how low can that voice get?
Yeah, that's a good, oh, so good. See what happens when you put trained singers in your movie, Disney? Go back to it.
Yeah, that's because he says this line, and then we get the triplets, who are very into Gaston, and very much for what he is. Like, they know that he's a brute, they know that he's a jock, they know that he's just this burly man, and they like the fact that he's a burly man. Honestly, if Gaston had went for all three of them at once, I don't think those three would have minded.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine.
Yeah, they're perfectly fine sharing Gaston.
I think they're the kind of ones, though, that they would have started infighting among themselves very quickly if he'd have shown them any attention. You know, that would have devolved into, like, a hair-pulling cat fight in the town square, I think.
Sisters fighting sisters over a man. What's come to this town, man?
Yeah.
So, this is a point in my notes where I make the high school analogy, but we've already made that.
Yeah.
So, I think that's all we can say about the song Belle. Because, you know, the town they see Belle is this... They know Belle is special, but they, yeah. She's also strange. She doesn't think the way everyone else thinks. She doesn't act the way everyone else acts. So they think there's something wrong with Belle.
Interesting. Another little behind-the-scene thing about this opening song is apparently Alan Menken wanted to scrap it. Because apparently after they wrote it, he went to Ashman and said, this will not work because they didn't ask us for a 7-minute opening number, Howard. And apparently Ashman was like, no, it'll be cool. Trust me. It'll be fine.
And he was right.
And he was right. I mean, goodness,
I don't know how you could introduce
a genius.
Cause you introduce three of the main characters in this song and you know everything you need to know about them.
Yeah. You know, the entire town. At this point, even the kind of background characters.
So after Belle ends, you know, Gaston tries to hook up with Belle because, like I said before, he's the hot guy, she's the hot girl, and he wants his trophy wife. Belle is not interested. It's just she's just showing no interest in him at all. And the book abuse from Gaston here.
Yeah, if you want to make me hate a character, have him do something awful to a book.
Yeah, he throws the book into the...
I hate it, Gaston.
He disrespects the book for not having pictures, probably because he can't read, because, you know, given the time period, he probably doesn't know how to read.
Yeah, that would probably be accurate, yeah.
So he throws the book into the mud, again, showing that he has no respect for Belle, because that's Belle's personal property, officially, because the bookseller gave it to her. So that's Belle's personal property, and he's just showing no respect to it at all. Throwing it into the mud and saying, you know, you should be with a good-looking guy like me and get your nose out of that book because what you like doesn't matter and what you should concern yourself with is me.
Yeah. And in so many words. I mean... yeah, it's interesting because Gaston looks like... He's supposed to be the Disney prince.
Yeah, he looks.
I mean, he's a little more muscled than most Disney princes, but he looks like he should be the love interest of this movie.
Yeah.
And also, again, musically, he doesn't realize he's the bad guy. I mean, he probably doesn't realize he's the bad guy until the very end of the movie when he's, you know, meeting his end.
I've made poor choices in my life.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the last thought going through his head was like, this could have gone better, you know. But the thing is like, I love a villain.
That thinks they're the hero?
Yeah, that really does think they're a hero. And Gaston is probably the earliest version of that in Disney. I mean, Ursula knew she was the villain.
I think the best, I mean, using a modern analogy, Hans from Frozen.
Yeah. I mean, he's, you know, he's very much kind of Gaston 2.0.
Yeah.
In that sense. But yeah, I mean, Maleficent knew she was the villain of this story. You know, I mean, the evil witch in Stepmother in Snow White. You know, I mean, you can't be dipping poison apples and going like, I'm the hero here. Like, that just doesn't work, you know. You've already accepted your villainy at that point. But I liked a lot of modern Disney movie, or the kind of Renaissance into modern. I like that in the Renaissance they started playing with villains who think they're the hero. And it was very much started with Gaston. And then I think it kind of reached its pinnacle in Hunchback. Mm-hmm. I mean, Frollo thinks he is the godliest man on the planet, and he is absolutely the villain. Mm-hmm. So I like that we've started here with a villain everybody can relate to. Because you know that all the bullies in your high school were not like, I'm going to wake up and go be a bully today and ruin some kid's life. they're just like, I'm going to wake up and it's going to be fun and it's not a big deal. I'm just having a laugh.
So, Kudu, I mean, got to give it to Gaston in a bit that he kind of tries to appeal to Belle by kind of defending her father. But it's still, it's very shallow.
Yeah, very. Everything Gaston does is incredibly shallow.
Well, he is a very shallow person.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, and, you know, yeah.
And, you know, if the remake is kind of correct to what Gaston is in the animated, then he probably would have known how to read. In the remake, he's like a military officer.
Yeah.
And they absolutely at that point in time in France would have had at least functional literacy, if not
basic
extravagant literacy. Yeah. Because, you know, I mean, movable type really got the literacy going through the roof. In the cartoon, it's a little less obvious as to what he does. He just seems to be like the town hunter or whatever. He might come
well, considering
from some money.
Yeah, considering later in the movie, he might own that bar.
He might be the owner of the bar. We don't exactly know.
And if he's the owner of the bar,
they let him decorate it for.
Yeah, if he's the owner of the bar, no wonder he's popular.
Yeah, I mean, true. But also, this being a small town, yes, literacy would have been higher than we probably think when we're thinking about that time. But this is, you know, like I said, this is after movable type. This is, I think, they're supposed to be sometime in the 1800s and all. So there still would have been a lot of poorer people would have still been illiterate, but anybody with a little bit of money would have had at least functional literacy. And Gaston does appear to have some money from something, mm-hmm. whether it's owning the bar or hereditary or whatever.
He could just be selling his kills for money.
Yeah, I mean, but still, it's a slightly higher percentage, but he reminds me of my students who do not, like, what's the point of this? This isn't fun, you're making me do this as a punishment, you know, he seems that kind of thing, that maybe he's not completely illiterate, he has the capability to understand, but he's just completely incurious and considers it, like, not a fun thing to do.
All right, so let's move on. Let's meet Belle's father, Maurice the Inventor. He's you know, not very successful inventor, but, you know, he eventually gets his invention to work, this automatic wood chopper. And for this time and place, that's actually not a bad thing to have.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Especially considering he's an old man, so to, you know, have a machine that can chop his wood for him.
But here's the funny thing, though, is that this thing is run off of coal, which was a lot harder to get at the time than wood. And so, because you see it later, that the Chip is kind of putting coal into this and blowing on the embers and stuff. So coal-powered wood chopping machine would kind of be very economically inefficient at the time. So it's kind of a cool thing that he came up with, but it would not be a useful invention, I don't think.
It would have been just easier just to pay Gaston to chop
the wood for him. Yeah, you should have just paid, like, a human to go chop your wood. It would have been much more cost-effective there, Maurice. Not nearly as cool, though. I mean, points for coal.
But he's an inventor. He's got to make something, you know?
Yeah, and the scene introducing Maurice is absolutely contains my favorite visual gag in the movie. When she's like, Daddy, do you think I'm odd? And he goes, my daughter, odd? And he pops out and he's got, like, the goggles with all the doohickeys springing off of it every direction.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. I want to talk about that because, honestly, taking away the comic aspect of it, it's a really good heart-to-heart between father and daughter.
Yeah.
It's Belle. She doesn't really have any friends in the town. Again, something that you can relate to, since you've mentioned before that you didn't really have a lot of friends growing up.
Yeah, at this age, I definitely did not have friends. Like, at the age that I would have been watching Beauty and the Beast, like, not a friend in sight.
So Belle has no friends. She has no one to talk to. No one that really understands what she wants. And then, of course, Maurice mentions Gaston. You know, he's a good-looking guy. He's a handsome fellow. And Belle, she doesn't deny that Gaston's good-looking. But, he's also a jerk. So she pretty much says it's not going to work. Yeah, he's, for lack of a better term, he's hot, but we're incompatible.
Yeah, which is great. It's possibly the first time we see a Disney princess kind of going for, like, I want to know somebody for longer than 20 seconds, and he needs to have something other than looks or have saved me from danger or be a prince.
Yeah, and granted, they kind of hammer that home in later movies, again, like we said before, like Frozen. But this is the first one. I think that's kind of what you were saying before, of the anti-princess, almost.
Yeah, and like, like Ariel, Belle is very much a heroine who is not in the right place.
Yeah.
She needs to be somewhere different. And that becomes, a huge theme. After this point, that becomes kind of the standard.
In the Renaissance, yeah.
And to some of the more recent ones, I mean, Merida is very much not where she is supposed to be, or maybe geographically she is. She seems to have no problem being in the town she's in and the stuff, but she wants a little more self-determination.
Yeah. Carve her own path rather than have one card for her.
Yeah, and Tiana, it's more of a social place. She's not in the social place that she wants to be in. But yeah, these kind of like out of place princesses is really much I think Disney doesn't quite get the credit they deserve for kind of, people look at it and they're like, oh, Belle is very beautiful and Ariel is very beautiful and they're all young and thin and whatever. But internally, they've got a lot more going on than I think a lot of people really want to give them credit for.
All right. So Maurice fixes the machine. He's off to the fair because he wants to win the prize. Hopefully it's a cash prize because, again, it doesn't seem like they have a lot of money. So, this is where we're introduced to Philippe, the horse. And
yay, Philippe!
So,
Philippe is the possibly even the first, at least in the main Disney movies, in a long line of non-verbal but very visually expressive Disney animal sidekicks.
Sentient, but not verbal.
Yeah. He's definitely got something going on upstairs, but it's not, he's not capable of speech. And that becomes slightly more standard than the talking animals that we usually associate with Disney princesses.
Yeah, and as we go through these films, we'll discover that later on.
Yeah.
So they get lost in the forest. Wolves, bats, Philippe gets spooked. Maurice gets knocked off, poor Maurice. Gets abandoned by his horse. But he's in a better place because now here's the wolves chasing him. To the castle! And this is where we see the Beast Castle again, and we get Lumiere, voiced by the amazing Jerry Orbach.
Yes.
Again, another classically trained stage actor. Granted, I guess more people in our generation who don't watch Disney would be more familiar with him with his role in Law & Order.
Yeah. I never was, because I never watched Law & Order. Or as Baby's father from Dirty Dancing.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So. But again, he originated the role of, was it Billy Flynn in Chicago, if I believe so?
Yeah.
So he knows his way around the stage. We got Cogsworth, David Ogden Stiers, and of course Mrs. Potts, voiced by the legendary Angela Lansbury.
All three of whom were massive Broadway stars.
Yeah, again, more people in our generation would know Angela Lansbury for Murder, She Wrote. Let's kind of be honest on that one. Outside of this movie.
Yeah, well, and honestly, I was not aware, and this is very odd because I grew up in a very Broadway-loving family, but I don't think I was aware when I first saw this that Angela Lansbury could even sing. And my parents were like, oh, that voice, that's the woman from Murder, She Wrote, and she could sing. And I was like, oh, wow. But of course, you go back now and you watch, you know, all of her old Broadway work, and you're like, man, she could sing.
Yeah, they again, kudos to Disney, for at least for this one, getting a lot of professional stage actors who knew how to act and sing as these characters. And, you know, Chip. Lovely little Chip.
Yeah.
Little Bradley Pierce.
Yeah. Okay, so as far as the plot goes, this is a major divergence from the
original story.
How Maurice or Belle's father ends up at the castle. The most common in the older story was that Belle had asked him to bring back a rose, and all from the fair. And since he never made it to the fair, he is looking for something to bring back for his daughter, and he sees a rose garden in this castle and decides, well, one rose won't be, and the Beast catches him as a thief. But I like the way that they changed it for the Disney movie, because the Beast's kind of original sin, if you want to call it that, was not being hospitable to a guest looking for refuge.
Yeah, and kudos and, to the... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and Maurice comes in the same way. You know, he's not a thief who's looking for a gift for his daughter. He's lost. A man who is lost, beset by wolves, desperately needs some kind of refuge and comfort. Not in a literal storm, but, you know, in this kind of storm. So this is our first meeting of the Beast, but also our proof that in the intervening years since the curse, he has not
matured in any way.
Yeah, he has not changed. So that when we see the change later, we know it is because of Belle in his life, rather than just years thinking about why he ended up cursed.
And of course, Beast, voiced by Robbie Benson, another accomplished singer. I don't know if he was a stage actor or not. I think he is.
Yeah, he definitely was a voice actor by this point, though. So this was not his first thing, but he was more of a live film actor and television actor.
I looked him up. He's like a teen heartthrob at one point.
Yeah, and he was in Ice Castles, which was a movie my mother absolutely loved and watched constantly. So that was another big one from my childhood. But yeah, he was not, though, like really the appropriate. I don't know. I always wanted to be in the room when somebody was like, who should we do for the Beast? And somebody goes like, Robbie Benson, you know, because I want to see what that, you know, I mean, he could have been Luke Skywalker. He was a teen heartthrob. He was, you know, I don't know. It's like, who do we want to get to be the big imposing Beast? And then somebody goes like, Justin Timberlake or whatever. It's like that kind of disconnect. in your brain.
Yeah.
As the, like, this is not the right type of casting for this.
But it somehow worked for this movie.
But it works beautifully. So, I mean, bravo to whoever decided that this is who we're casting.
Maybe
because
he auditioned.
His previous work. Well, I'm sure he did. But what I'm saying is his previous work would not have been like, you know, like, oh, yeah, that guy. I think of him as the big gruff, you know. Mm. No, he was like the young, cute teen star, you know. He wasn't like the big gruff beastly man. So bravo.
I do have my notes here of Maurice has had a very bad strain of luck in this 24-hour period. So he's trying to get his invention to work. None of his inventions ever work. He finally gets one that does, so good luck to him. He's off to the fair to win the prize. They get lost, so bad luck. He gets knocked off the horse, more bad luck. Chased by wolves, more bad luck. Sanctuary in the castle, good luck. Treated kindly by the staff, good luck. Oh, now he's captured by the beast and seen as a thief. Ultimate bad luck.
Yeah, I think that Maurice forgot that castles don't have phones.
That's a different movie. A movie that we cannot review on this show.
I don't know, with Fox being absorbed now into the Disney overlord vault there, I do think that Frankenfurter now counts as a Disney princess.
Queen.
Disney queen. Yes, alongside Elsa.
So, let's move on here. Gaston shows up to Belle's house. The whole scene is again, perfectly encapsulates, perfectly describes Gaston here, because he has an entire wedding set up here. He has the archway, he has a cake, he has a clergyman, he's got the guests.
The band.
All of this for the wedding that he hasn't even asked a girl to marry him yet.
Yeah, you want to talk about overconfidence, man.
He is so sure that Belle is going to marry him, and marry him right now, that he's got the wedding set up right now. And again, poor triplets crying. The fact that Gaston invited them to the wedding says a lot.
Oh, yeah, so cruel.
Like, imagine...
But also, this has got to be the social event of the year. I mean, Gaston getting married would absolutely be the biggest thing to happen in this town in years. So it doesn't matter how heartbroken they are. They have to see and be seen at the social event. Yeah.
So okay, go ahead. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
The way Gaston treats Belle when they are alone... As a little girl, I did not get it, but rewatching as an adult woman, again, just so many red flags of so many women have been in that position of the guy who won't take no for an answer. The way he traps her against the door.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, as an adult and as an adult woman. That, oh man, that is a horror scene right there. Cause you're like, Belle's gonna die. This is absolutely, and it's played for comedy and mitigated a little bit. And you know, Belle does get the upper hand and opens the door and stuff, but oh man, everything about that in a different movie would be like,
horror.
That would end with like, and we found her body stuffed in the woods. A day later, like, so this is, I think, for an adult woman, the moment you know Gaston is a villain.
Yeah.
Like, you had hints before in the movie, but the second that he's, like, physically over Belle, trapping her against a wall, theoretically where she can't move, and refusing to take no for an answer, like, that right there is the absolute villain turn.
Just want to backtrack for a minute. It's just the look on Belle's face when she realizes Gaston's at the door.
Yeah, and I love the little peephole, you know, invention that Maurice has. It's just so great.
It's like, oh god, now I gotta deal with this guy again. But, you know, it's all small town. I can't really tell him I don't want to talk to him because blah, 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 small town.
I have been socialized to be nice to men in all circumstances, lest they get mad and hit me. Yeah.
Again, more book abuse because he puts his freaking dirty boots on the book.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. The dreams. Today's the day all your dreams come true. And he just talks about his own dreams. Like, yeah. That, those are the only ones that matter. Belle's opinions, Belle's dreams, Belle's wants, Belle's needs do not matter. The only dreams that matter are Gaston's, which again shows you more of his opinion on himself and really opinion on women in general.
Yeah, and you can definitely tell that his only desire for a wife is someone to cook and bear children.
Yeah.
That is it. And like, not just bear children, but, like, be a broodmare. I mean...
Six or seven.
Like, no. Too many kids. No. Bad.
Now, to be fair, if it was, in fact, six or seven dogs, I think Belle might have been into it.
Yeah, six or seven dogs, I am there. Yeah. I mean, I will show up give a for bit of a giant smile. Pile of puppies.
I mean, granted, it's a nervous smile, but it's a bit of a smile when she thinks the idea of seven dogs. You know, hey, yeah. Belle...
Please tell me you're talking about dogs and not treating me like a broodmare. Nope, I was wrong.
I mean, I imagine, you know, a guy's kind of a jerk to you, but he'll straight up say, hey, you know, we get together, we're going to have like a whole house full of dogs. You'd at least contemplate it, you know? At least
I would contemplate that for a few seconds, and I'd be like, do I get to keep the dogs in the divorce? Because that's where I would need to go with that. I will marry you. We will get the dogs, then I am divorcing you and keeping the dogs. Thanks for the dogs.
So, but again, like you said, you know, Belle is able to get Gaston out of the house in a very, very tense... In any other movie that wasn't a Disney movie, it would be a very tense situation. And then Gaston, humiliated, thrown, you know, his own momentum throws him in the mud, but essentially Belle throws him into the mud.
Yeah. But, and I love that the pig head... That rises up, you know, that he ends up under a pig.
Because, symbolism.
Yeah, symbolism. I mean, this man is a pig. How much more do you need the movie to say it?
And he goes straight up, you know, now it's his mission statement. You know, no one says no to Gaston. He makes it his mission statement to marry Belle. Like, this woman rejected me. No one rejects me. I'm going to make this woman mine one way or another.
Yeah, it's all about his pride.
Yeah. Again, well, that plays into the rest of the movie. So now we get the reprise of Belle, which is pretty much her I Want song.
Possibly the shortest I Want song in Disney history.
Yeah. She doesn't want to be someone's wife. She wants her own life. She wants adventure. She just wants someone to understand her. I think that's the basic... Yeah, she'll say, I want adventure, I want a life, but you can get the sincerity when she just wants someone to understand her.
Yeah.
She just wants someone to essentially value her. Not just value her physically, but value her as a person.
Yeah, I mean, it's great and it's relatable. You know, I want you to know me as a person. And I think most people can relate to that. I think that's a very common idea.
Mm-hmm. So, anything else on the Belle reprise?
I mean, that sweeping shot of the valley that mm-hmm. comes into her kind of, you know, doing her Maria Von Trapp on top of that mountain, you know, that is probably this movie's version of Ariel on the Rock.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing they put in everything. Her with the dandelions and the sweep down into the valley. That, oh, the backgrounds in this movie are so gorgeous.
Well, that and
every background painting. Oh, my goodness.
I would say that or the ballroom scene.
Well, yeah, that too. But this is very much the movie of, like, big sweeping crane shots, you know? Like, in any movie, this would be a crane shot.
Yeah,
but,
for lack of a better term, they actually shot this as if it were an actual movie rather than just a cartoon.
Yeah, I love how they thought of camera motion. This is probably the most cinematic film, you know, especially if you go back and look at the classic Little Mermaid did it a little bit better, but it's very much a, you know, a static camera in a lot of the early animation. And Beauty and the Beast, I think, was the first time that they were like, you know, why don't we have these kind of, you know, why don't we do these sweeping helicopter shots and crane shots and, you know, zooms and all this kind of stuff, but like in animation.
Well, they didn't really have the tech then at this point, since this is one of the first animated movies to use computer animation. They actually have the technology to do it.
Yeah, and I love it. I mean, it really was groundbreaking in so many ways. But I like that the second they were, you know, like, hey, can we take this technology? Can we use it for something more than just, you know, just kind of more fantastical backgrounds or whatever? You know, they're using it in a little more thoughtful way. Mm-hmm. So
Philippe finally comes back home at this point, and, you know, Belle's on her way to get her father. How does Philippe know where the castle is? Because Philippe bailed before Maurice ever got to the castle.
I mean, maybe Belle's a tracker. You know, maybe she's got some kind of tracking skill.
Maybe. Philippe recognizes the scent, maybe. I don't know if that's how horses work or not.
here's my blood horse. We're going to go out and onto
find
some
my old
game.
Man, yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, Philippe's kind of sentient. So I assume Philippe kind of took her back to where they would. And, you know, I mean, I hate to say it, but you don't need a lot of tracking skill to follow a panicked dude breaking limbs and falling through the mud while being chased by an entire pack of wolves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, just follow the trail of destruction. Oh, look, a castle.
So, Belle finds Maurice, and, you know, Belle meets the Beast for the first time.
As she's walking in, Cogsworth is berating Lumiere. And I love that one of the things Cogsworth says before they notice Belle is he calls Lumiere waxy-eared. Which, just such a perfect little, you know, kind of, and I'm not even sure I've ever really clocked that joke. Ha ha, pun, because Cogsworth. But I'm not even sure that I really got that joke through my head until I was watching it recently, and I was like, did he really just call him waxy-eared? That was, somebody went out of their way for that joke.
And, you know, they noticed that, hey, there's a girl in the castle, and everyone went, there's a girl in the castle. Poor Chip, Mrs. Potts doesn't believe him.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that, again, in a different movie, this scene would play so vastly different. Because if you remove all the asides with the servants, this is an amazing horror film. I mean, everything about the atmosphere, the way they've got the music doing, the way they've done the lighting, this is straight up horror film. Except that it keeps bouncing back and forth to, you know, talking candelabras. Like, which, I mean, I could see that in a horror film. That could work.
Beauty and the Beast is a horror film. Let's, you know, YouTube filmmakers, get on that.
Yeah. I mean, it's beautiful. I love it, you know, because I'm also a horror film nerd. So I love every bit of the way they pull from those tropes. Like, you just expect Vincent Price to pop out of a of a shadow and be like, oh, Belle, welcome.
Yeah. Vincent Price is in a different Disney movie. We'll get to that one.
I know.
Let's go back to Belle, Me, and the Beast, and, you know, Maurice, and that whole scene where Belle sacrifices herself for her father's safety, which is, you know, very noble, very, very Belle, as we know her at this point in the story.
Yeah, and I like that it's not unthinking. Belle immediately thinks about all the consequences of this, and she does it anyway. This isn't like Belle later going like, well, I didn't realize that I was going to be, you know, stuck here with a beast. She's like, I am going to live the rest of my life until I die in this dank, cold cell. Worth it. I love my father that much.
And it's a lot better than it was in the original story, where it wasn't even Belle's decision.
Yeah. I mean, I like the agency of Belle being like, no, this is what I am willing to do for my family that I love.
And she has is her dad.
Well, yeah. And also, I like that she immediately has an emotional reaction. I did it, but I'm still going to feel afterwards. Because she says, done, and then she, like, collapses into tears because she knows that this is not a good thing. But she's still willing to do it. She doesn't ever try to back out.
And Maurice has a point. It's like, he's an old man. He doesn't have long anyway. Why is Belle throwing her life away just for this moment? And it's Belle loves her dad that much.
Yeah, I mean, and we see it over and over again in the movie. Like, this is a girl who would do anything for her last remaining family.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, then the very, you know, with the music and the animation, the separation of Belle and Maurice.
Oh, goodness.
You know,
yeah.
Belle, you know, never gets a chance to say goodbye. Even say in the movie, she never gets a chance to say goodbye.
Yeah. But I have to admit, one of my, like, favorite background characters in Beauty and the Beast is in this moment. Because to this day, I still love the little spider carriage.
Yeah.
Like, as a kid, that was the creepiest thing in the movie. Like, when that carriage came to life and just started skittering off in the same way a spider moves. Like, oh my goodness. Like, as a little kid, I was like, no! Spider carriage! It's coming to get me!
And the sound effects.
Yeah, it's got the little skittering sound effects as well. It's just, that's so perfect.
And, you know, Beast tells the carriage to take the father back to the, take Maurice back to the village. Okay, how does this carriage do it without no one seeing him and, you know, getting the whole mob thing off about an hour before it's supposed to happen?
Everybody's in the bar with Gaston.
Yeah,
because afterwards Maurice is just wandering around a deserted town being like, somebody help me. So, you know, I mean, everybody, literally the entire town is in that bar.
All right, so again, kudos to Lumiere for actually getting Belle out of the cell and into a proper room.
Absolutely. The Beast has some lack of imagination, and it's shown over and over again in this scene. Like, you know, Belle's like, what can I do for you, man whose curse involves having a beautiful young woman fall in love with him before, like, next Tuesday? And Beast is like, there is nothing you can do! And I'm like, really? Really, Beast? You have been spending at minimum a decade, at maximum 2 decades, thinking about how do I get a beautiful girl to my castle to break my spell, and one's just like, hey, I will literally do anything to save my father, and your first thought is, can you say you love me? You're like, what? Come on. Like,
I bet it, I think,
there's nothing you can do. I'm going to leave
it
in the air.
It's Disney, so it has to be true love. Like, it has to be real love. It can't just be, oh, you
know. I know that, and you know that. But if you were cursed under a spell, you'd be trying to, like, you know, rules lawyer that thing. You know you would.
I was like, okay, so there's this thing. I don't normally look like this. I look really, really hot under this thing. But I can't do this unless I kind of go on a date. Can we go on a date for just...
Yeah, this is the Ariel, like, why didn't Ariel write things? Like, why didn't the Beast, like, just level with her? Why did nobody in the castle be like, look, we're all really human, okay? I wasn't born a teapot, okay? There was a witch, and she didn't like, and he's not really such a bad guy, he's just had a really awful life. If you can see beyond that, maybe I could be human again, and live the rest of my life as not a teapot.
You know, can you two get along for a day, maybe?
Yeah.
So, but Beast tries to be hospitable, but again, it's been a while since, and even before then, he doesn't seem to have been a very hospitable person to begin with. He was Gaston at the start of the story.
Yeah.
So he doesn't know how to be civilized, I guess, despite being a prince.
Yeah, I think empathetic is the better
Okay, that's what I'm trying to find.
I think that's what Gaston and the Beast both have in common at the start of the movie. They are not empathetic, and you see that immediately with the Beast like grabbing Maurice and just yeeting him out a window. You know, it's like it didn't even occur to him. And you can tell the way they do the animation later with his reaction shot. She's like, "You didn't even let me say goodbye." And he was like, "Oh, right. This is her father. She might have wanted to say bye."
I'm a jerk here, aren't I? Yes, you are. Oh,
yeah. and I think the difference between the Beast and Gaston in the end is that the Beast is willing to like take a step back and be a little introspective. He's willing to ask, "Am I being the jerk here?"
Mm-hmm.
And Gaston would never, the thought would never occur to him that he's being the jerk.
No.
No matter how many times he's told he's being the jerk. But, you know, somebody tells the Beast, like, "Hey, maybe you're being a jerk here," and he kind of does stop and consider it.
Yeah, so, you know, even in his own way tries to ask Belle for dinner, but he's more, but it's more of an order. He's trying to ask her nicely, but it's coming off as an, he actually says, "You will join me for dinner." Like, not, "Would you like to have dinner?" "You will join me for dinner." So that's what he's saying.
That's what a prince would say.
Yeah.
I think the anger afterwards of, "That's not a request." It's, I think to him, that would have been the prince saying, "You will join me for dinner." Yes, it's a royal command, but it's also a kindness, you know, like, you get to have dinner with the prince, aren't you lucky, you know, and that would have been the way he was raised.
Mm-hmm.
You know, princes don't make requests in that sense, at least not at that point in time, definitely.
I want to see more about it, but the thing I want to talk about is later in the film, so
okay.
do you want to move on?
Yeah, moving on, okay.
Gaston, the song.
Yes.
The villain song that's...
It's not a villain song.
Exactly.
Yeah,
In any other movie, this would be the hero song.
Yeah. I'm telling you, Howard Ashman is a master lyricist in this one, and it just... Everything about this song is perfect.
Like, it's... And also says more about the town, how the town is... singing Gaston's praises, you know, Gaston has been disgraced, publicly humiliated, and he's just in this slump because no one has ever told him no, and he doesn't know how to react to that.
Yeah, no one in this town has ever told Gaston no, which is a fascinating thing to know about the town. And once again, it's perfect small town life. You know, I could name three or four people in my small town now that it's like, "You do not say no to that guy. That guy is the big cheese. How dare you not kowtow to, you know, the fish in the small pond." So
Gaston is pretty much the local celebrity for whatever reason. Again, maybe because he's the great hunter that brings the food during the winter. Maybe he owns the bar. That's my big thing. You know, maybe he owns the bar.
And you're really dealing with that bar theory. I love it.
You know. Again, he decorates the bar in his own or tavern. That's in a, it's this kind of thing. It's not a bar. It's a tavern. So, yeah. You know, he decorates
it. How is that any different than, and once again, I'm not sure if this is a thing you would really get if you live outside of a small town, but I can go into, like, any number of restaurants in my tiny little town, and there are the pictures of the local heroes and newspaper clippings of when our high school won the football match and when our college won the football match and when some random peewee league won the football match. It's really, there's a lot of football around here. but, you know, there's also... You know, there's the local color on the wall. And I wonder if just all this town has is Gaston.
Yeah, maybe. But yeah. And he's clearly loved and admired by the entire town.
Yeah.
Which one thing I hated in the remake is that having, you know, the town kind of ignores him anyway. And LeFou has to pay the town to sing his praises. I hate it.
Yeah, I did not like that part.
But in this one, in this version... You know, it's very clear that Gaston is a local hero. Everyone loves him. Everyone sings his praises. You know, when LeFou said everyone wants to be you, that's genuine. Everyone in that town wants to be Gaston.
Yeah.
So and we have this big number and singing the praises of Gaston. Like I said, in any other movie, this would be a song about a hero. And yeah. In the town's eyes, Gaston is the hero. And in Gaston's own mind, he's the hero.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not even sure if you can call just Gaston the villain of this piece. I mean, the town kind of collectively is really...
I'm getting there.
The villain of this piece,
I'm
I think.
Getting there.
All right.
I'm getting there. I have a thing to talk about that, but we have to get to Maurice running
we
into
have
the...
a theory, y'all.
We have to get to Maurice running into this tavern.
Yeah.
Maurice runs to the tavern. Beast taps his bell. They think he's crazy, and then throw him out because, you know, beasts don't exist and all that stuff. So Gaston is forming a plan to get to Mary Bell. And he's thinking of it because of crazy old Maurice. And
it leads to one of my favorite lyrical twists. Le Fou, I'm afraid I've been thinking, a dangerous pastime, I know. I love that. That's such a great thing. Just...
So he's, and then, you know, okay, go ahead. I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you. I'm sorry.
No. It's just that I love that turn of phrase that, you know, they're both like, oh my goodness, thinking. How horrible.
Well, even earlier in the movie, Gaston was saying, you know, thinking with a very disdained look in his face. Like,
but
thinking. Who wants
he
to think?
Talked about women doing that. But the fact that they even do it to themselves, to the big manly men, like, we shouldn't be thinking, we're action. You know, like, so, don't think about things, do things.
So him and Le Fou are very openly talking about this plan. They're going to do something to Maurice. Now, the other patrons in the bar, they don't know what they're talking about because Gaston's whispering. But everyone else in that bar, they know that Gaston is going to do something to Maurice.
And, I mean, the song, who persecutes harmless crackpots like Gaston.
So
I mean,
he
already announced their plan to the entire bar.
So the entire town, they know that Gaston is going to do something to Maurice that will involve him being incarcerated. And they're on board with this.
Yeah.
The entire town is in agreement that Maurice, whether this beast exists or not, needs to be locked up. And that Belle needs to marry Gaston. This is the way. Oh, wow. This is the way. Mandalorian.
This is the way.
This is the way. Spoilers. So, I mean, this is the way of the town. You know, the previous girl needs to marry Gaston, and anyone who is against it is an enemy of the town. Like,
yeah.
I guess more small town thinking, you know, you're pretty much the expert on that.
Yeah, I mean, this borders a little more into, like, dear leader kind of thinking. Like, dear leader will have the prettiest girl in the village. Anyone who speaks against dear leader, you know, like, yeah. So, slightly less small town and slightly more North Korea, but...
Cult.
Yeah, cult. The
cult of Gaston. But poor Maurice. All he wants to do is help his daughter. No one wants to help him because, one, everyone already thinks Maurice is crazy anyway because he's an inventor. And everyone already thinks Belle is crazy because she's a reader. So, why would they want to help either one of those two because they're the outcast? Why do we want to help them? They go against the will of the town.
Yeah.
So, that's it. Back to the castle. Belle doesn't want to have dinner with the beast, and I don't blame her. Because, you know, she just lost her father just a few hours ago.
Yeah, you're a prisoner in a castle with a bunch of magical objects and a, you know, 8-foot-tall beast. I think that would put anyone off their dinner.
Yeah, but there's a very cute scene with Lumiere and Mrs. Potts trying to give dating advice to the Beast.
So adorable.
You know, it's
And if you've ever gotten dating advice from well-meaning people, that is exactly how it goes.
Like,
be forward, but not too forward. Be nice, but not a pushover. You know,
consider what she wants, but also remember what you want. You know, it's like, it's like, and most of all, you have to control your temper.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big one. Dating advice from us here at Rewatching the Magic: always control your temper, please, please,
yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, if any characters is going to have dating advice, it would be these two. Because one, Mrs. Potts. So obviously, she was married at some point.
Yeah. And we already know Lumiere's a player.
Yes.
Come on.
Lumiere's a playboy, so he knows if you want to have a woman's affections, you have to be a caring person. Even though he is a playboy, you do have to show them that you are...
Yeah, he doesn't seem lecherous in that way.
No.
He seems a very affable playboy.
Yeah. Yes, he adores women, but it's more of a... not in a conquering way, I guess.
Yeah.
He generally loves women, not... Yeah. Not of, you know... Moving
not
on.
As trophies, yeah. as people.
Not as... You know,
or feather dusters.
Or feather dusters. Yes. Oh, Cogsworth. Poor Cogsworth in this scene. The entire animation and the lines and the delivery is like, well, she's, that's kind of a thing. Well, she's in the process of, she's not coming.
Yeah, if you've ever had to deliver bad news to a boss, you feel for Cogsworth in this scene. You're like, please do not fire me. I am only the messenger. I had nothing to do with this.
Then there's a scene I was talking about before where Beast is just going up to Belle's door and is just trying to get her to come out, and he's going to break down the door. And he is like, he's trying to be very nice, like, I would want you to come downstairs. And then, you know, Belle says no. And then the look he gives the object is he's pointing to the door like,
Yeah.
He's being unreasonable.
Do you see this? I love the little animation bits in that scene, because there is one thing that I noticed on my rewatch that was so adorable, was he's trying to be nice to Belle, and he says, it would give me great pleasure if you would join me for dinner. And the thing is that when he says pleasure, they have his tail wag a little bit like a dog when it's happy.
Yeah.
On the word pleasure. Yeah, so I love the fact that you can see he's actually telling the truth, because like that little twitch betrays him, which I like.
The Beast, he is genuinely trying to act like a gentleman, but it's because of his situation, it's very hard for him to do so.
Yeah.
And Kuzma, he is actually trying to be nice, and it's just not working. Because, again, the situation the situation that both parties are in.
But also, this is still a self-serving nice.
Yes.
We know that the Beast is trying, but, again, it's like the Gaston's shallow attempts to be nice to Belle.
Mm-hmm.
Is he wants something, and so he's putting this, like, civilized veneer... But it's still an incredibly selfish act.
And then he goes to the, if she doesn't eat with me, she doesn't eat at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, again, like you're saying, it's very shallow nice.
Yeah.
I have a note here that he's gone full nice guy in this scene.
It really is. He is very much in what we would now call the nice guy mode. Is, I will be nice to you in exchange for you giving me something that I want. And the second that you reject me, I am not the nice guy anymore.
Yeah.
So.
Like, he is...
Again, as an adult woman, this hits all kinds of different notes.
I gave you a nice room. I gave you all these nice clothes. Why don't you go to dinner with me?
Yeah.
And you know, no.
Yeah.
So... Invasion of privacy with the magic mirror.
Yeah. Not great. Not a good look for you, Beast. Don't be a creeper.
But it's in this moment that, you know, she still sees Beast as a monster, because he's kind of acting like a monster. And it's kind of a bit of a realization moment for him, because he starts to really lose hope at this point.
Yeah, he starts to see... himself, how she sees him.
Yeah, as a monster. Now, who can ever love him? Because he's... Not only does he look like a monster, he's acting like a monster.
Yeah, which, as we learn, is the bigger problem.
Yeah. So, you know, Beast isn't doing himself any favors by acting like a jerk. And he knows this, but he just cannot snap himself out of that mode.
Yeah. But once again, introspection.
Yeah. This is, in the Broadway version, we get the song, If I Can't Love Her at this point.
Is that where they put it? I always thought it was. It was like at the end when she leaves.
No, no, no.
Oh wow, that is way too early in the play for that song. I've never seen the stage version. I own the soundtrack.
I think it's that She Can't Love Me. I think it's at that point. Then it comes back as
I can't love her. Okay. Yeah.
So she wants him to, you know. Moving on. That's, you know. But we're getting besides the point at the movie because we need to get to the showstopper.
Yes.
So Belle finally leaves.
Speaking of Broadway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Belle finally gets to the room, finally gets to the kitchen. She says she's hungry. Big showstopper, be our guest. Again, a song.
Also, Cogsworth is, like, kind of a jerk in that scene because she's like, I'm really hungry. And he's like, you know, crust of bread, go back to your room. It's like.
In a way, he's kind of trying to defend his master. He's like, hey, he offered you a big fancy dinner. The stove cooked up a big fancy dinner. You didn't want to eat with him, so you're not going to get the fancy dinner. You're going to get the
And Lumiere immediately is like, dude, no, big fancy dinner.
Yeah,
I have a song ready for this, and you will not stop me from singing it.
The song that's so catchy that again, Disney uses this song to advertise their cruise line, their hotels, and their parks.
Yeah.
Be our guest. Come and be our guest at our facilities, you know?
We will give you a song and dance and presumably good food.
So this is where I put my note. Despite this movie taking place in France, Lumiere is the only one with a French accent.
Well, I mean, Bimbet has a French accent. The Feather Duster.
Yeah.
And yes, they named the Feather Duster Bimbet. Seriously? Seriously? Come on, Disney. Also, interestingly, Bimbet is voiced by Cartman's mom. Seriously, it was Mary Kay Bergman did the voice of the Feather Duster. So that hot Feather Duster that you've been thinking about all these years.
Cartman's mom.
That was Cartman's mom.
We can't go into what the show called her, so try to keep this CG.
No. Cartman's mom. All right.
So 10 years since we've been dusting, doing so much more than rusting, bringing back the question of how old was his beast, but you know, I'm going to stick with my theory that he's just been a beast for 21 years and everyone just stopped aging, just because the picture is of him as an adult, not as a child.
Yeah, it does make more sense in the animated version to think of it that way.
So, the big feast, the big number, you really can't really... Describing the song and the whole scene won't do it justice. You have to see this.
Well, yeah, and... Okay, Be Our Guest is a good song. I'm not going to say it's not. It's excellent. I think that Under the Sea is a little more catchy in terms of earworm.
Mm-hmm.
But what Be Our Guest has over it is that this is more of an animation tour de force.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they really pulled out all the stops for this number. And, yeah, they kind of did for Under the Sea, and you've got all the fish and stuff. But, like, they went overboard. And
this is showing off that technology.
Well, that too. But there are so many things that, like... Not even the parents would have really gotten. I mean, not all of them, at least. If you are an old Hollywood nerd, this is so old Hollywood in the way that this is filmed, in the kind of little nods in the animation. You get nods to Esther Williams. And her, you know, with the synchronized swimming of the spoons and the diving off into the punch bowl and things like that, you get, I mean, half of this number is Busby Berkeley. And if you are not an old Hollywood nerd, you know, all those overhead images where you see, like, dancers on the floor making these incredibly elaborate shapes, that's Busby Berkeley, okay? And they do that so much. I mean, they really, somebody had to walk into the animators and was like, we want a Busby Berkeley number, and then Esther Williams comes in the middle of it. go animate that, because it is spot on.
So after dinner, Lumiere and Cogsworth going to give her the tour. And I love how the say this for Belle. Belle uses her own feminine charm on Cogsworth to get the tour.
Yeah. And I'll the interesting thing. Oh, I did want to say one more thing about Be Our Guest, which is that Mrs. Potts talks about wine.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the tobacco in The Little Mermaid, not really a thing you'd see today. But I did not see this contains mention of alcohol in kids' media warning on Disney Plus the way I saw a tobacco warning on Little Mermaid.
Hmm. Interesting.
So, it may be there and I just missed it, but I kind of went looking for that and I did not see it.
Hmm. So let's go to this tour.
Yeah, they go on the tour. It's very nice. And you know that still to this day, every one of you listening, when somebody mentions the Baroque style, you always think, and if it's not Baroque, don't fix it.
And this is where I mentioned earlier of the knights checking out Belle. It's like, come on, guys.
Well, also, this is probably the first human they've seen in over a decade, right?
Yeah.
Come on. I mean, it may not be that she's hot. It may just be that she's breathing. You know?
And, you know, Cogsworth gets him back in line. It's like, hey, guys, you know.
Yeah.
Back to work. Which says a lot. Where were these knights when the attack happens later in the movie?
Yeah. We could have used your help, guys. What? Come on. Step up.
So, they're trying. Belle tries to get up to the West Wing and, they stop her because they know what's in the West Wing, but Belle doesn't know because they're hiding it from her. And then they mention the library. And Belle went, oh, the library. I'll look at all the books. And then, you know, Belle still ditches the tour and goes up the West Wing anyway.
Yeah. I love how well Belle plays Cogsworth.
Yeah.
And it's not so much her feminine wiles, I think, you know, because she doesn't – she's not, like, you know, making puppy dog eyes at him.
Go ahead.
But she appeals to his knowledge of the castle. She kind of does the, like, please, and then he doesn't fall for that, and she goes straight to his ego and his knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I bet you know more about the castle than anybody else. And I like that it's another sign of her empathy and her ability to read people. She knows that this dude prides himself on being a knowledgeable authority on something.
Mm-hmm.
So she plays into that. And I love it. It's another little kind of subtle Belle moment on how good she is on that level.
Mm-hmm. So Belle goes up to West Wing and finds the rose. You know what's coming at this point. Belle finds the rose. Beast finds Belle. And, yeah, he does go overboard, but considering what the situation is, if Belle had touched that rose and all the petals fell, Beast's it kind of SOL at that point.
Yeah.
And, of course, Belle doesn't know what she would have done because no one's told her anything.
Yeah, I think just being a little more upfront with Belle would have really gone a long way in this situation. Communication, people. Communication. Use your words.
And then, of course, he yells at Belle. Belle is rightfully scared out of her mind. Especially with the fact that not only is Beast yelling at her, but he's breaking furniture in front of her. Again, a red flag moment.
Yeah, super red flag. But I like that Belle does kind of stand up for herself. I agreed to stay here in this castle. I did not agree to violence.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, she was perfectly willing to stay in that jail cell and rot.
Mm.
She would have done that. She would have kept her promise. You know, once they give her... You know, the run of the castle, she didn't even try to escape. I hate that they put that in the remake, by the way, that Belle tries to escape in that way.
Mm-hmm.
It is only after Beast crosses a line that she ditches. You know, like he broke the code first.
Yeah. You know, well, I agreed to be civil with you. I didn't agree to abuse.
Yeah, Belle is a woman of principle. Good for Belle.
So Belle gets the hell out of there with Philippe, but
who has just been hanging around? Like, what was Philippe doing? Like, just wandering around the courtyard? Like, I guess I'm gonna stay here.
Yeah, especially since Belle's supposed to be there forever. Why is Philippe still there?
Well, nobody told Philippe.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like anybody went out and was like, Philippe, we're keeping her. Go back home.
So, but the wolves are still there. And there's that whole scene with the wolves. Again, beautifully animated.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so brilliant. And it's got that same kind of visceral horror that some of the classic Disney movies did. You know, you're in a dark forest, there's tree limbs reaching out to get you, there's, you know, animals there. I mean, this is really very much like a Snow White kind of horror set piece.
And as it looks like Belle's about to get eaten by freaking wolves. Oh, yeah, Philippe has bailed again, so. You know.
No, Philippe isn't bailed. He gets caught in the tree.
Oh, yeah, okay.
He gets caught in the tree and he can't move. Okay, yeah, the reins.
I'm mixing up my scenes.
Yeah.
So enter the Beast to save Belle after, you know, he screwed up earlier. He's risking his own life against all these wolves to save Belle because he put her in that situation.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, beats up the wolves, scares the wolves off, but he's injured. He's very injured from the wolves' attack. And, you know, Belle could have ran. Belle could have just bailed on him.
And she does consider it. I like that they put her considering it.
Yeah.
That she's like, okay, Philippe, time to go. Oh, crap. He's really injured, isn't he?
Okay, so here's the thing. How did Belle lift the Beast onto Philippe?
Belle, much like Flounder, is a secret gym bunny. That is my official theory on this. I have a theory, and it is that Belle is hitting the gym because nobody in the town will talk to her.
Belle lifts.
under those nice, poofy white sleeves of her underdress, Belle is swole.
Okay, now we get the whole scene of Belle nursing the Beast. And it's a very beautiful scene, and these two are finally communicating to each other.
And I like that Belle doesn't shrink away.
No, she stands up for herself.
He yells at her, and she's like, it wouldn't have happened if you, yeah. And so, good for you, Belle. Lay down those limits.
And then, you know, you get Beast, he's trying to retort, and think, okay, yeah, you're right on this one.
Yeah. Your logic is flawless, madam. I cannot disagree.
So, I mean, it's kind of the start of, I guess, the beginning of their friendship. I guess you can say that.
Yeah, because right after that, the next thing we really get with them is he's like, you know, hey, I kind of feel something for this girl, you know. So I think that really is the moment. You know, she could have run. He treated her horribly. But
he did risk his life to save her.
He did risk his life to save her, and she respected that.
Yeah, it's her paying him back for risking his life by at least, you know, making sure his wounds are mended.
Yeah.
So back to the town. Gaston wants to have Maurice committed, gets the asylum guy in there. If she doesn't, you know, if Belle doesn't marry Gaston will have Maurice committed. And again, this is the start of Gaston going full villain, at least in terms of the general Disney sense.
And also, this may be Tony J's first Disney movie?
Mm.
Is this Tony J's first Disney movie? Because he is the asylum, the guy who runs the asylum, Monsieur Dark. Once again, bit on the nose there with that name. But that is very much the amazing Tony J, who would later play Frollo.
And yeah, you would. And you mentioned before, Gaston has money.
Yeah, it does. It does seem that Gaston is loaded because he does pay Dark very handsomely.
And, you know, he's even at this point saying, you know, why am I going to commit this person who isn't legitimately crazy? He's kooky, but he's not crazy. He's harm. Okay, Maurice is harmless. He even says that. Maurice is harmless. He hasn't harmed anyone. But once he sees the money, he's like, hey. Then he's all for it. I mean, he's even saying that he loves the idea of committing Maurice. So
Yeah.
it's like even these people, you know, even the people in the asylum, even everyone in the town seems to not like Maurice and not like Belle.
I am going to point out a bit of unfortunate real world history that watching this movie, you're like, oh, this is a cartoonish portrayal that you could just like pay somebody off and then have somebody car. No, this is what asylums were like. Prior to the kind of mid 1900s, even the early 1900s, we were still doing this to people. The idea that you could pay somebody off and have a family member or a rival in town or whatever is this was how a lot of asylums made their money. I'm not gonna lie. This asylums were not a place of rest and rehabilitation. They were a prison for people who had not necessarily broken a law. So the fact that Gaston is doing this would have been very, very common in the 1800s. The only thing different is that they're doing it to a man, and usually this was a tactic done to control women. So, yeah, an unfortunate bit of history, but very accurate, even though it does seem very overblown and cartoonish in this. This would have been quite realistic.
All right, moving on. Maurice is off to find Belle alone because he's a good papa. Say what you will about Maurice, but he's a good papa.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Philippe comes back and they're off to find Belle. But Gaston just misses Maurice at this point. I mean, so they're off to do this. Gaston's off to do this right now. We're gonna go to Belle's house. We're gonna get Maurice arrested.
Yeah,
We're gonna.
it's not Philippe. He doesn't have Philippe when he goes.
Oh, he doesn't have Philippe.
Yeah, that's
Why
right.
would
Because
he think Philippe is there?
remember he's on foot, and Philippe is back for the start of something there.
Okay, so yeah, I'm confusing this with Philippe here. But anyway, so Belle's
Philippe is not the teleporting horse.
Maurice is off to find Belle alone, and Gaston gets there just a little too late. Imagine what happened if Gaston had gotten there and Maurice was there, but Belle wasn't, you know? Oh,
Yeah.
we're gonna wait till Belle gets back. Oh, Belle's not coming back. So it's like, oh well.
Yeah.
So he tells LeFou to stay until they get back, and then, you know, and LeFou gets covered in snow and becomes a snowman. A snowman played by a guy that played LeFou. I don't know if that's gonna work or not.
Yeah. I mean, come on, you're already like foreshadowing the later years of Disney. Disney's just recycling stuff at this point. Seeing it before. Get some new ideas, Disney.
So we're back at the castle at this point. Beast, all healed up. He wants to do something nice for Belle. He realizes he's been a jerk. You know, he wants to do something nice because he just, you know, he's been a jerk to Belle. He wants to do something nice to her. So what does Belle like? And finally, you know, I think it's Lumiere that makes the idea. It's like,
Yeah,
oh,
Lumiere.
I have the perfect thing that you can give her, and Beast gives her the library. Obviously, he's not using the library, so someone has to use it.
This one shot, you want to know what every nerdy girl dreams about? We dream about that library. Like, we don't dream about marrying the beast, we dream about having access to that library. That is the only reason any girl wanted the beast. Like, when I grow up, I'm gonna marry the beast because he has a big old library, and then maybe he'll go to the West Wing, and we don't really have to see him that much because library.
And that's another long-running joke among fans about this movie, that this is when Belle starts to turn around on the Beast because the library.
Yeah, this is not. I mean, there's that big, like, this is just a movie about Stockholm Syndrome. No, it's not. Learn what words mean. But yeah, this is definitely. I think she would have been like, no, I'm fine being a prisoner here. Just make sure I have lots of candlelight and keep that tea coming, Mrs. Potts, and I'll just be here for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I'm just going to read every book in this library.
Yeah, twice. 'Cause that would have been me as a kid. Like that little me watching that when they revealed that library, I was like, I have never seen anything like that, and I want to go there. That is heaven, and I want to live there for eternity. Thank you.
Ooh, this one's first edition.
Yeah, this one's first edition. Yeah, he was a prince, so he probably had a lot of like really cool stuff in there.
So let's go to they find. So obviously, having the big library given to her, the least she could do at this point is have dinner with him at this point, or at least
Yeah.
lunch. At least lunch,
Yeah, lunch.
since it's oatmeal.
Or maybe breakfast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's the least you can do is just have a meal with the guy. He did give you this big library with every book ever written.
Yeah. It does appear to be like every book ever written by that point in human history, yeah.
So and then we get into the song. Some no though, because we got to get
I went
to.
to a college that did not have that many books in their library. Not gonna lie, that library put my college library to shame.
So obviously, I mean, the beast is trying to be human for Belle in eating the oatmeal with the spoon. Obviously, he hasn't used utensils in quite a while.
Yeah, interesting thing. I love that Belle compromises on the bowls and picks the bowl up and drinks from it.
All right, that will lead us into the song Something's There, which, now we start the feelings start to develop between Belle and Beast. There's, he was mean, he was coarse, he's unrefined, but now he's dear. He's starting to soften. She's starting to see that there is some shred of humanity in this beast. And she's starting to kind of fall for him because of that bit of humanity he's starting to show.
Yeah, and this is just such a great little bouncy song. In the behind the scenes thing I watched with Alan Menken, they were talking about something there, and Howard Ashman was incredibly sick when they got around to the recording. And was at the point where he couldn't really speak very well, and definitely couldn't be in the studio. So Paige O'Hara was in the studio recording this, and Menken was kind of overseeing it, and he would call back to Ashman and kind of tell him what was going on and play him little bits of things. And Paige O'Hara was having trouble with the new and a bit alarming. And she was going, like new and a bit alarming, and just kind of following the rhythm of the song, and it was coming off as very flat and dry. And so Menken called Ashman and said, like, listen to this, it's all wrong. And apparently Ashman croaked out the words, tell Paige Streisand. And that was the only thing he could say. And so they told that to Paige O'Hara, and it became new and a bit alarming, which is exactly how Barbra Streisand would deliver that line. And it's perfect, and it was what ended up in the movie.
And yeah, and then it's also the callback to Belle, the melody of Belle in that song.
Yeah. True
Very
that he's no Prince Charming. I mean, the same
Broadway-esque.
repeated. Yeah, this really is just such a Broadway movie, because all the tricks that Broadway composers use are in this. The reprise and the recitation of previous lines and the matching of the lyrics, using Prince Charming earlier and Prince Charming here, things like that. It's just great. And this song gives us a great kind of trio of three Broadway greats when when you get Jerry Orbach and David Ogden Stiers and Angela Lansbury doing their little trio bit.
And their voices work so well together during that last part.
Yeah, and I think it really was the only time they ever kind of did any of that.
The only sad part about it is I'm pretty sure they were not in the studio at the same time doing that.
Well, no. Yeah, they really Disney now will occasionally do group records, but at the time it was absolutely like I'm not sure any of these people met each other until the premiere.
I do want to backtrack a bit to Beast's verse that, you know.
Yeah, the only time we get to hear Beast really sing.
Yeah. Which is why, you know, they kind of gave him his own song in the Broadway version.
Yeah.
So, but you know, he is also seeing that Bella's being more open to him, more kind, but he's kind of doubting it. Like, you know, no. She can't have feelings for me. Yeah, we're friends, but she doesn't love me. She can't love me. No. So he's very, you know, doubting. Still a bit of doubt there.
Yeah, and I love the way that Robbie Benson delivers the line, and when we touched, she didn't shudder at my paw. It's just such a great little bit.
I think that's the only way, at least for this movie, to have Beast sing, because otherwise he would have to talk like this and sing like that, and it's like that's.
Yeah, you're hearing more Prince Adam.
Yeah,
I think at that point, and also it's really the only time we get a window into what Beast is thinking.
Yeah,
where it's just him. He's not performing for anybody else. He's not being the master of the castle in front of his staff. He's not performing for Belle. It's just his inner monologue, which I kind of like, and I wish we'd gotten more of.
And again, that song is beautiful. Even when poor Chip, he has no idea what's going on. He's too young to understand.
Yeah, they really harp on that, you're too young to understand, which takes this to a very uncomfortable place as an adult.
Yeah.
Because children are absolutely old enough to understand romantic love.
he doesn't know where this thing is going. I know they like each other, but what's going to go there? You know, are they going to get married? You know, at this point, he's probably thinking that. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, but it goes to a little weird place when you keep going, I'll tell you when you're older. Don't ask that. You're not old enough to know that.
Patronizing children.
Yeah, okay. Don't patronize your children. Yeah.
This part that I want to talk about is not on Disney Plus, but I want to talk about the song Human again. Are you familiar with it?
Yes, I am.
Okay, this is not on the Disney Plus version, but Human Again is a deleted song from the film that Ashman wrote. It made its way back when the Broadway version came out, and they put it back into the movie when it was re-released for its 10th anniversary.
Yeah, but it's not in the version currently streaming on Disney Plus.
No, it's not. But I do want to speak because someone's going to talk about this.
Yeah.
Someone's going to say, oh, you didn't talk about Human.
Don't add us.
Don't add us. We are going to talk about Human again. So, and it's one of the things that this is the song that I really wish was in the remake. Granted, they put a different Ashman song in there, but this was the one I really wanted in that remake. Because you now get more of the Enchanted staff. You get more of their insight. You know, you kind of get more sympathy towards them. It's just, they're just as much prisoners as anyone else in that castle. Yes, they're the staff. Yes, that's their master. The Beast is their master, but they're still trapped there. They're trapped as these objects, and they have just as much, if not more, to lose than the Beast does.
Yeah.
That flower wilts and Belle doesn't love Beast, they're stuck as those things forever.
Yeah, and honestly, I mean, once again, did they really deserve that?
No.
I mean, you can talk about did the Beast deserve that, but it's pretty clear that these poor little, you know, servants were not there.
So yeah, if you have the movie on Blu-ray or something, the song's there, but the song is not even on the extras of the movie on Disney Plus, and that is a shame.
Yeah, apparently one of the reasons it was cut was because it was originally going to be 11 minutes long. That something there wasn't originally in the movie. They were going to do this, like, 11-minute showstopper about...
They already did.
Human again.
Yeah, they already did.
Yeah. And so they kind of cut it, and they cut it down to, you know, something there, which is like 2 minutes flat. So, but it is, and then they used the kind of shortened version of it for the Broadway.
Yeah. And this is the only time where you actually get to find out what Lumiere did in the castle. He was the cook. Because there's a line that Lumiere says, "I'll be cooking again."
Yeah, and it just, I'm like, really? That was your plan for Lumiere? Because nothing in the rest of the movie suggests that. Like, I would absolutely have pegged Lumiere as a butler.
Obviously, but
I mean, seriously, he has the, or like a footman, maybe.
Maybe.
I mean, I think Cogsworth would have been like the butler over the whole place, but Lumiere, I would have pegged as like a footman or some other kind of maybe a dresser, in the sense of like, you know,
the royal fashion person for the
no,
prince.
No, but like literally the guy who dresses the prince. Because clothes at that time, if you've ever participated in any sort of recreation of anything before the 1900s, clothes worn by royals up until like, you know, 1900 something, not a thing you can put on by yourself easily. You absolutely required servants to get into those clothes, even the men's fashion. So it was absolutely essential that you had someone to help you dress. So that was an official position in the royal household.
All right, so let's. I think we can move on from the deleted scene back into the movie proper.
Back into the movie proper.
So now we get this nice scene between Beast and Lumiere, where Beast is very nervous. He's very clearly nervous. He's, you know, they're essentially going to go on their first date, official first date, with Belle. Beast is going on for his official first date with Belle in this scenario. He is very open. He really does care about Belle. He wants to tell Belle his feelings, but he really is still unsure. Again, we had it in something there. He's unsure that Belle shares those feelings. He doesn't know if he even should confess those feelings or not.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, once again, that's a very kind of common human sentiment of, you know, I got a crush on this person, but I'm not sure they feel the same way about me, and, you know. So it's a really kind of humanizing moment for Beast in the fact that you can super relate to what he's going through.
And yes, the scene is played for last with the haircut, but the overarching sentiment is still there. You know, Beast is, you know, it's a humanizing moment for him.
Yeah. And, you know, funny because they are playing on the ridiculous sort of fashions of 1800 France at that time among the royalty. Once again, that's kind of just a history nerd thing. But when you see, like, his hair with all the ringlets and the bows and stuff like that, that was kind of the fashion. It's just translated for Beast's face and mane, so he ends up looking a bit like a poodle, but once again, poodles, French. So, there we go.
Then we get to the title song, Beauty and the Beast, sung beautifully by Angela Lansbury.
According to Mencken, this was the song they had the most trouble with. Because the title, like, you know, we want you to write us a song called Beauty and the Beast, about Beauty and the Beast, and he's like, there is nothing to suggest what that song is going to be about. Honestly, it's just the title of the movie. And the fact that they broke with the kind of Broadway way they were doing the movie, because this is a straight-up pop song.
It became a pop song. We have Celine Dion singing during the end credits.
It's written. It's written as a pop song. This is not written as a Broadway ballad. No. This uses every musical trick of 90s pop. Late 80s, early 90s pop. But yeah, this there's a reason Celine Dion was singing it in the credits. I mean, this is a straight-up pop song. So, yeah, the fact that they kind of ended up with that is a bit shocking, because that was not, I mean, Little Mermaid did not have the pop song singing, you know, the pop star singing the Under the Sea at the end or anything, you know.
No, no.
This is a very new thing, and it's a tradition that Disney has continued, and maybe they probably shouldn't have, because those pop covers of the song in the movie are always just the worst. Please, Disney, stop.
Yeah, you're really going to hate Frozen 2 then.
Yeah, I really don't like the, like, and now this cool song from the movie, but really bad. And it always is. It's always like some kind of bad American Idol version, except it's sung by somebody that you want to have respect for. You know? And then you're just like, why are you doing that? This was a beautiful song until you get a hold of it. But yeah, but we got to talk about the other thing in the scene.
Hmm.
Beyond the song, this is where we get the CGI.
Yeah, I was almost going to get to that. You know, yeah. This entire scene is beautiful. You know, this is where the computer animation gets to the entire ballroom. You know, the way they film it, you see the doors open and the entire ballroom is computer animated.
And once again, seeing this in a theater at 10 years old blew my mind. This was just absolutely unlike anything I'd ever seen. It wasn't like the first time CG animation had been used in a movie. It was, you know, it wasn't groundbreaking in that sense, but melding it so kind of perfectly with the 2D animation and making it look relatively seamless.
Yeah.
Especially at the time. Looking back on it now, it doesn't quite hold up as perfectly as you would wish.
It's early 90s CG animation.
It's very, I mean, it's still beautiful, but there are a little, like in the close-ups of the faces while they're dancing, the background does not track as smoothly as you would want it to. And there is a point where some of the columns in some of those close-up shots start to curve at the top of the frame. And so it is slightly off-putting, but the wide shots absolutely hold up.
Yeah.
The chandelier is a little, the gold bits on the chandelier are a little early 90s CGI. But I mean, overall, it's, and I'm still amazed at the absolutely beautiful reflection animation that they get of them dancing in the highly polished. It's still to this day, that's witchcraft. Just, I do not understand.
To me, this is, you know, like you said with Ariel on the Rock, to me, this is the shot. Like, this is the shot that you always see when they talk about, oh, our Disney classic movies, and, like, this is the shot they use. And
yeah, that crane shot down through the chandelier into them dancing in the frame. Yeah, it's absolutely. I would agree with you, those two. But if they're just going to talk about Belle by herself, it's the little Maria von Trapp on the top of the mountain with the dandelions. Yeah.
And again, the whole scene is beautiful. The song, Angela Lansbury's voice is beautiful. The whole scene's beautiful.
Yeah.
So, and of course the uses of the angels on the chandelier, kind of leading in and watching Belle and Beast dance.
And even right to the end of the song, when they walk out on the balcony and there's like the meteor shower and the, oh, just that sky still looks just so beautiful.
Yeah. So I guess we can continue on.
Yep.
So Belle obviously misses her father. She wants to see her father again because, you know, the whole night is a perfect night, honestly. And in any other scenario, this would probably be the best date she's ever had.
And probably the only date she's ever had. I'm going to call that. This is probably the only date she's ever had.
And it's with a prince, technically. But, you know, the point it being that, you know, it's this very wonderful night, but there's still she still misses her father. She never got to say a proper goodbye. She misses her father. That's the only family she has. So the Beast gives her the magic mirror to see her father. And, of course, obviously Maurice is
near death in the woods.
Yeah. He's an old man trying to get through this woods and trying to find his daughter, and he just is not doing too well. So, in the ultimate
also, act... I want to point out how it is perfect weather at Beast's Castle. Clear skies, beautiful stars, everything's like, you know, Belle doesn't even need a wrap when she goes out on the balcony. Maurice is dying of hypothermia in the middle of a windstorm in a forest 20 feet away from them.
Enchantress magic.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, she gave the Beast some really nice weather. You're going to be a Beast, but it's going to be gorgeous.
Except for that one snowball fight, but that's, you know, we already
well, no, but still, that is the most beautiful snow ever. Like, it snowed in the middle of the night, and there is this perfect pristine snow. They come, I mean, you live in the Midwest, dude. Come on.
Yeah.
We have both seen what snow in the Midwest looks like. Yeah. That is some beautiful snow right there.
So, Belle in the, a Beast, I mean, in the ultimate act of humanity, lets Belle go. You know, he truly does love her and is going to let her be with her father.
And gives her the mirror.
Yeah, gives her the mirror.
So that she can look back on the Beast and see him.
Yeah, like, hey, if you miss me, you can visit, quote me, that way. You know, he's learned... Go ahead.
And I feel so bad for the Beast that he thinks that she would never return to the castle. He is absolutely certain that once she leaves and she's reunited with her father, at most... she would look in the mirror every now and then to see if he was still alive.
Yeah.
Again, that's how little he thinks of himself and his relationship with Belle at this point. That she would never even come visit him.
Mm-hmm.
That's just so heartbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, that's again, we've been talking, it's been the last few scenes. It's like, he truly does love her, but he does not believe that a woman that, of Belle's personality in general, could ever love someone who looks like him. So he still sees himself as that monster, even though he is essentially becoming more human, even though he still looks like a monster.
Yeah, but also, I mean, if you want to go back to the Beauty and the Beast as high school thing, this is very much the, like, you had a really good friend at school, and now they're moving away, and, for you younger kids among our listeners, back before the internet, you'd have to give them something called your address and hope they would write you a letter, which was when you put pen to paper and sent it in an envelope through snail mail. And so it's very much the Beast kind of giving her, like, here's my address. Maybe send me a letter and tell me how your life is going. You know, and it just, like, and if you ever had that happen, you know they're never going to write that letter.
Yeah.
Like, even then, we didn't like writing letters. It was our primary way to communicate over a distance, and we still didn't do it.
Yeah. But ultimately, my point being, the Beast has finally learned to love someone. He's finally learned to
and
put
not
some...
selfishly.
Yeah, no, yeah,
this
no.
is a very unselfish form of love. This is exactly what Belle did in saving Maurice at the beginning of the movie. It is, someone I love is in pain, and even though I know that this will ruin the rest of my life, I am going to help the person I love who is in pain.
Yeah,
because this is much a death sentence to Beast as Belle thought it was when she agreed to stay in the castle.
Yeah, he's putting, for the first time, essentially for the first time in his life, he's putting someone else's needs before his own.
I mean, granted, he is not at all considering the needs of the staff.
Yeah.
He's got hundreds of people in this castle that are desperate to be human again. We just almost had an entire song about it. So, maybe, but yeah, okay, let's go with the...
Yeah.
Let's keep it simple and say that this is a selfless act done out of love instead of screwing the people who have been, you know, loyally following you for decades.
Another long-running talking point of this film, Belle took time to change clothes.
Yeah, my father is dying in the woods. Let me, but honestly, that's kind of a. I mean, have you ever tried to go anywhere in a hoop skirt with seven petticoats? And I mean, seriously, there's no way she's getting on a horse at that point. She pretty much had to change clothes out of necessity.
Yeah. So, keep your
That's
eye
the
on Chip.
practical side of Belle.
Keep your eye on Chip for this one, because he's gone off. So finally, Belle finds Maurice, takes him home, and we find out that Chip is stowed away in the bag. Poor Chip, because he didn't think, why did Belle go away? He thought
Did she not like us anymore?
it.
Yeah, it's such a little kid
Thing.
move. It's like, there's a divorce or something, and it's like, why did Uncle Bobby go away? Does he not like me anymore? It's like, well, no, that's just, your aunt drinks and Uncle Bobby left. But it is a very appropriate little kid reaction to something.
Yeah, and now we have the entire town has come to the house to take Maurice, because LeFou finally, LeFou as Olaf has finally, he's seen that Maurice and Belle have returned. LeFou in his Olaf cosplay. So LeFou tells the town, "Hey, Maurice is back. Belle's back. Let's get this plan underway." The entire town is out to lock up Maurice.
Once again, nothing happens in this town. This would be the social event of the year.
Yeah.
This would very much be like, you see blue lights flashing and crime scene tape in your neighborhood, you're gonna go down there and look.
Yep. But they're all there with freaking torches. They're not
Well,
there.
it's dark. But yes, I agree.
This was not a social visit.
Yeah.
So Gaston, he pulls his plan. Hey, I will use my influence to not have your father arrested if you marry me. And obviously Belle is like, no, not even in this situation, because obviously she has the mirror. No one else knows she has the mirror. But Gaston is like, have it your way. If you're not going to marry me, then your father is going to get locked into this asylum, and is going to get tortured for the rest of his life, which might not be a very long life, honestly, considering he's an old man.
And asylums were known to spread disease and cause early deaths in the people
Yeah.
who lived in them.
So Belle uses the mirror, shows him the beast is real. "My father's not crazy. Here's the beast. Just as the beast was real, now you can let him go." Yeah. Good idea, Belle, but you really are underestimating this town.
Yeah, and also the beast is in pain and he's roaring and it makes him look,
Very
angry
evil,
and
yeah.
yeah, and evil. And
So.
of course, Belle with the entire point of the movie summed up in one line. He's not a monster, Gaston, you are.
Yeah, and of
I
course.
mean, that's the thing, Gaston says, "Look at this monster," and she's like, "No, you're in so many words, you are the monster of this story."
And of course, Gaston cannot fathom that. He's.
Yeah, no moment of introspection. Just immediately shoves Belle to the side. With the beast, that would have been he would have stopped and been like, "Am I the monster? What is she saying here? Let's rethink."
So
But
now.
Gaston's just like, "No, I'm right. It doesn't matter what you say."
Yeah, so he riles up the town. We have to kill the beast because, this is his. This. He's going to get rid of anything that's going to stop him from getting Belle, and the beast is stopping him from getting Belle. So he's going to rile the entire town up using fear. We get the mob song, and now this is the villain song. That's the villain song.
Yes, this is the outright villain song. But
Go ahead.
I'm gonna say this is still a villain song by people who don't realize they're the villains.
Yes.
To the audience, now that we know the beast, this is absolutely the villain song. But to the villagers, think about what they invoke God in this song. They're asking, they're screaming, "Praise the Lord," as they go off to kill the beast, you know, and of course, Ashman drops it once again a little on the nose, but he states it far out, you know, they do not understand the beast and therefore they fear it.
Yeah. The scene itself, this whole thing is very topical in that you have a very charismatic figure using fear and hate to rile up people to attack someone that's different than them. That is very, very, very topical in today's world.
And sadly, it is the human nature that this is topical at almost every time in history.
Yeah.
This mob, you know, quote unquote, heavily quote unquote, justice is, you know, it's a recurring theme in humanity, unfortunately, and as is bigotry. And this was a very personal movie for Howard Ashman. Everybody said, you know, that he felt like both Belle and the Beast. You know, he was, once again, a gay man. By this point, he was a gay man with AIDS. And, you know, if you did not grow up in the 80s and early 90s, I mean, but 80s especially, you really cannot understand the absolute stigma of the AIDS crisis when it was at its height. And it was horrifying. You know, the people would go to the hospital in their dying days with AIDS, and the nurses would put up caution tape and just sequester the room. They might slip a tray of food through the door, but it was basically solitary confinement until you died and they got your body out of there. Because even the nurses wouldn't touch you. You know, and homophobia was rampant, and, you know, it was still absolutely the thing to, you know, beat up the local gay kid and stuff. So this is very much Howard Ashman's response, I think, to the mob that was coming for those who had AIDS. Because there were a lot of people who saw it as, you know, God's judgment on a community that people didn't want around. That these were monsters, and now they were suffering monstrous consequences of their actions. And so when I hear this song, you know, the Kill the Beast, it absolutely resonates as something that, you know, a gay man suffering with AIDS at the time would have thought, you know, the entire world is coming to get me. That they don't, they're invoking God. They don't understand what this disease is, how you get it, how it's transmitted, how to protect against it. And they don't care to know. They just want to come for me. They want to treat me like the beast.
Yeah. You know? Even in the lyric, when they finally meet the castle, they say, "We are 50 strong and 50 Frenchmen can't be wrong." He's saying, yeah, that we all are of the same mind, therefore we are all right because we all have the same mentality.
Yeah, Belle is the one that has the, let's call it scientific knowledge. Belle knows the nature of the beast.
Literally.
And Belle is telling them, this is not a thing you have to fear. You know, I can tell you how to be safe in this situation. And they are not listening because, you know, 50 French men, I'm going to lean heavily on that men, because, you know, there's a lot of gender politics in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can't be wrong. They've decided. So this song is possibly the most brilliant song in the movie from a emotional and ethical standpoint. And it really, go listen to it again. Go watch that scene. Really pay attention to those lyrics, because it's all there in plain, you know, this is what you look like to the people you were coming for, you know.
Again, that song can be placed in any point in history to any marginalized people, and it works.
Yeah, and it's, you could have put that song against, you know, Esmeralda and the Romani people in, yeah, in Hunchback, and it would have had the same effect, almost entirely unchanged.
Mm-hmm. So, as the mob, you know, mob has locked Belle and Maurice up in their cellar, so, you know, so they can't just warn the Beast or anything about that, and they do their thing, they get to the castle. Beast has pretty much given up hope at this point. You know, there are invaders in the castle. He's saying, let them come. Like, I have nothing to fight for right now.
Yeah. If I can't love her, let the world be done with me. I mean, it's where they come back to in the Broadway play, but it's very much here in this version.
Yeah, if I don't have the woman that I love, the person that I actually genuinely care about, she's not here, I don't want to live, really, pretty much.
And also, I wonder if the Beast kind of just wonders, like, if I die, will the spell be broken for everybody else? I mean, if the curse is on me, if I can't lift it any other way, maybe this is the only way.
Yeah. Though, I must say, when they finally, you know, let the doors open and you get the big fight scene between the mob and the every enchanted object in that castle, and it's beautifully animated.
Yeah. Also, I love that the outfit that the wardrobe puts on the villager when she grabs the villager and drags him in, and, you know, he comes out in a different outfit, that it's very much a goofy version of Ariel's look.
Red wig, the purple bra.
Yeah, red wig, purple top, the kind of, you know, ruffle tutu in green, and the, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
That was on purpose.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, I like that they put that in because it's one of the first things, it's one of the first we get of what becomes the running Disney trademark of putting cameos in other, it comes in more in Aladdin, mm-hmm, but it does kind of start here.
So Chip finds the wood chipper. Like you said before, puts the coal in, starts it up, and frees Belle and Maurice, but the wood chopper is destroyed. R.I.P. wood chopper.
You guys gotta try this thing.
Get on a roller coaster.
Yeah, and I was surprised that that was not the Beauty and the Beast ride at, like, Chip's wild adventure on the wood cutting machine.
So, at this time, Gaston, he finds the Beast. He's all set to kill the Beast. And the Beast doesn't do anything. Again, he has, you know, Belle's gone. There's no fighting him. He's, you know, he's depressed, pretty much. Like, and we all have dealt with depression in various ways. You know, we all know friends that have severe depression, that there are times where they just don't want to do anything. They'll just sit there and do nothing, even if someone is trying to cause them harm.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, Gaston is attacking. He's beating the hell out of the Beast.
Also, we see Gaston at the beginning of the movie, like, cleanly kill a bird in flight in one shot. And he's, like, 20 feet away from the Beast. The Beast is not moving. And he can't seal the deal on that one. I mean, I know this is our hero and we don't want to kill him off like that. But, you know, what happened that Gaston choked? Like, he can't get a headshot from that.
It's also
distance.
Pitch black in that room.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's a big
not
fight.
Not sure I'm buying that one.
I mean, the Beast is not fighting back. Gaston is just, I mean, he probably could have killed Beast in one blow if he wanted to. It's almost like he's kind of relishing the kill. You know.
Yeah, Gaston is very much a sadist. He does kind of like watching things suffer, yeah.
Like, he's even taunted us, like, were you in love with her? Why would she want you when she could have me?
It's like, because, you know, a dumpster fire would be, you know, more interesting than you, Gaston.
That's still Gaston's mentality, though. Like, he is still the best-looking man in his world, or in the town, at least, and therefore, you know, Belle, I'll get rid of you, and then Belle will have no choice to marry me. It's still Gaston's own ego still fighting through, because it's like he doesn't understand that Belle doesn't want him. Doesn't understand that. even saying, you know, Belle's mine. She doesn't belong to, you know, she doesn't love you. She loves me. And then
he doesn't even go into love. It's just she's mine. She's my property. I saw her. I called dibs. Mine.
Yeah. So finally, Belle returns on Philippe. And finally, the Beast fights back because he has something to fight for now.
Yeah, you know? Belle came back and was like, Beast, you know, I don't want you to die. He's like, maybe fight back a little bit.
Well, yeah, like we were talking before, he had completely convinced himself Belle was never coming back. There was no way she was ever going to come back. And then she came back. It's like, wow, she actually came back. Okay.
She came to visit me.
All right, I'm going to kick this guy's butt now and just, you know, take care of this guy.
So, you know, I mean, we get to the point. I mean, Beast has him by the throat.
Yeah, Beast says he fights back, and he could have easily killed Gaston right there. That's like in my notes here, but he doesn't do it. It's like he knows if he lets Gaston fall, that he's no better than Gaston.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and, he's just as much the monster that everyone says he is.
Yeah, and honestly, this really is a turning point for Disney, I think, because this is really when they decided we don't want our heroes to kill things. I mean, Little Mermaid, you know, Eric straight up shanked to Ursula with a ship. But this one, you know, they're going with a different kind of ethical tactic, and one that kind of remains in Disney to this day. Mm-hmm. You know, like, the villain has to be taken out by the villain's actions, not by the actions of the hero.
Yeah.
So, you know, Beast puts him down, because, he, you know,
he's showing mercy, which, you know, the Beast at the beginning of the film likely wouldn't have. So, you know, he goes to Belle because Belle's there. You know, Belle finally, you know, made her way up to that part of the castle, and, you know, he's going to go to her because, you know, that's what he wants. He wants to be with Belle. And Gaston literally stabs the Beast in the back.
Yeah, because Gaston has no honor or sympathy or, yeah.
And it looks like they're both going to fall. Belle grabs the Beast to pull him back, and Gaston falls. Now, I mean, he literally, you know, this is his own, like you said before, this is his own actions. If he had just walked away at that point of mercy, no problem. Gaston would have been alive. He would have had a hurt pride. But again, Gaston is so prideful that he just could not end the match like that. He couldn't end the fight like that. He had to get one last shot in.
And he's not above stabbing an opponent in the back. I mean, it's like completely without any, you know, honorable combat idea.
Go ahead.
Which kind of makes sense, because what's the only things we've seen him attack until the Beast? Animals, who are not his equal.
Mm-hmm.
And LeFou, who is not his physical equal.
Mm-hmm.
He preys on things that can't really fight back.
Mm.
You know, we never see him take on a wolf or, you know, any of the actual, like, predators. We see him take down deer. We see him take down birds. We see him take down things that honestly can't really fight back against a hunter like that.
Yeah. In the original theatrical...
deer are kind of dangerous.
Yeah.
Trust me, I live in Deer Central. Deer are super dangerous. Do not let them fool you. But still...
It's not like Bambi?
Yeah, not like Bambi. I mean, a deer will straight up stab you with their antlers right in your gut, and you will die.
I just have in my notes, no one dies like Gaston.
No one dies like Gaston. And in fact, no one died like Gaston so well that they've just repeated it in every movie, pretty much, since then.
So, Beast is just, he's dying from this stab wound into his back.
And the arrow in his back, and the Beast clubbed with a stone gargoyle bit.
Not to mention his injuries from the wolves earlier in the movie.
Yeah, which probably still hasn't healed because it's only been a couple of days.
Yeah.
Tops.
And it's a very beautiful scene where, you know, he is laying there dying, and he just sees Belle. Like, that's enough. Like, he gets to see her one last time before he succumbs to his own injuries, and it's okay. He's content. You know, everything is okay for him because he got to see Belle one more time.
And he knows that she cared enough to come back for him.
Yeah, it may not be...
It may not be romantic love, it may not be, you know, he's still not clear on that, but it's enough.
Yeah. She cares for him, and that's enough.
Yeah, I am gonna say, Belle held up the beast's entire weight, once again proving Belle is swole. That is my official theory, you heard it here first. But I am gonna say about the emotion in this scene, I cried watching this rewatch. I cannot tell you how many times I have seen this movie in my life. Literally, I cannot count how many times. I have already said there was a point in my life where I watched this movie every single day. And that phase went on for a couple of years at least, okay? That's hundreds of times I have seen this movie. Possibly over 1,000 at this point. I still cried watching that scene on this rewatch.
Especially, you know, Belle is like, she doesn't want the beast to die. She just wants, you know, like, oh, we're together now. We can be together now. It's, everything's fine. And he's laying there dying. And it's like, it's a very emotional scene. Even if it's not romantic love, even if Belle did not feel romantic love for the beast, it's still, this is a person I care about. This is my friend who's dying. And I don't want my friend to die.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just brilliant, and everything about it, the way the music swells, Paige O'Hara's performance, oh my
god.
Robbie Benson's performance, you know, I got to see you one last time, it just, oh, everything about this scene still rips my heart into tiny little pieces and stomps on them.
And as the beast dies, Belle finally confesses that she does indeed love the beast. She doesn't, you know, she loves the person, the man, underneath the monster.
And honestly, I'm not even sure she knows at this point that there is a man underneath the monster. The only clue she's really gotten
was
is
picture.
The portrait.
Yeah.
And she doesn't know who that is. Because when she sees his face, she doesn't say, like, oh, hey, you're the dude in the picture. You know, she's like, who are you? Belle is still completely in the dark about any of this. I don't think she knew to this point that the servants used to be human, that the beast used to be human. This is completely... She's not doing it to fulfill anything. She's saying that she loves the beast for who he is as the beast in all of his beastly glory.
Mm-hmm. The last rose petal falls as she's confessing her love, and the spell is broken.
In a beautiful fireworks show.
Yeah, the transformation.
That animation is great.
The transformation is beautifully animated. That's my note here. It's beautifully animated. And it's like the whole change, and then he becomes the prince again. And, you know, he turns around, and there's that face, you know, like. And Belle is completely confused, has no idea what's going on. Like, who is this guy? Like you said, who is this guy? And he's saying, you know, it's me. It's me. And I love how she can really tell. She looks into his eyes and sees it's the same eyes as the beast. And then that's when she realized, oh, it is you.
I am going to say, though, super disappointed as a kid when I saw Prince Adam. I was like, bring back the beast. The beast was, like, adorable. And Prince Adam is not. And I hate to say it, but I had the exact same reaction watching the remake. They do the transformation into, you know, into the prince. And even though I like the actor, he's great. I love him in Legion and everything. But the way they have him styled when he turns from the beast into into the prince again, and I was like, nope, do not like, bring back the beast.
Do not want.
Yeah, do not. I have never, ever found any version of Prince Adam attractive. Please, please stay as the beast, maybe, and we will just have a romantic but asexual relationship after that point. Thank you.
So, you know, Belle and the prince finally kiss after, you know, all of this, and everyone else gets to transform back into humans. Yay!
Yay!
So, it's everyone has the happy ever after, except for Kastan, who street pizza.
Yeah, I'm gonna say that it was really, really, really fortunate for the Enchantress that all of the servants had names that lent themselves into being turned into inanimate objects.
Lumiere.
You know, Lumiere is a light, so candle. You know, Cogsworth is a clock. Mrs. Potts, that one writes itself.
Yeah.
Chip, okay, well, his mom's a teapot, he's a you know, I mean, it's just, everything is very kind of on the nose there as well.
Of course, I have my notes here. Chip having the last line in the movie, do I still have to sleep in the cupboard?
It was such a great line. Also, do you think Mrs. Potts hooked up with Maurice? Because they're kind of a little close there at the end, and they do look of an age with each other. So
we don't know what happened to Mr. Potts. Again, the remake hasn't happened yet. We don't know what happened to Mr. Potts.
Yeah. So yeah, I do kind of wonder about that, because when I was rewatching that, I was like, ooh, they seem a little friendly.
And you know, how old? And you know, I guess like I was saying before, Chip can't be more than like 5. And it's like, how old was Mrs. Potts when she had Chip?
She could be a person who just grays very prematurely. Those people exist.
I know.
I started going gray at around age 15. So the women in my family gray extremely young. So yeah, I mean, you know. She could very much still be childbearing age and have completely white hair. Especially, you know, we also don't know what she looked like before. Like, maybe those, like, 20 years stuck as a teapot really did a number on her stress levels.
Maybe.
Yeah. Another quick story from childhood. So, when this came out, they had the Beauty and the Beast Barbie dolls.
Mm-hmm.
And the Beast doll had a mask and like a padded suit that would go over that would make him the Beast, and then you could take that off and put on a different outfit, and underneath that was Prince Adam. And Prince Adam has long hair. And as I have already stated, I came from a very conservative culture in which men did not have long hair. Men had 1950s businessman hair, and that was it. That was the only acceptable hairstyle. So, as a little kid, I'm like, well, he's nice, but he has long hair, and that means he's, like, evil, or whatever they told me as a kid. And so, I took my safety scissors and absolutely just chopped almost every bit of hair off of Prince Adam.
You act like you're the first kid to ever give their Barbie dolls a haircut.
Yeah, but I mean, he ended up with like this like really weird punk rock, spiky, uneven, awful. I think I still have that doll in my collection because it was so funny to me when I found it in a storage bin as an adult, and I was like, this absolutely was the like religious brainwashing of a little kid as a doll.
So yeah, the only thing I have here in my notes is something we've talked about before, that this starts another Disney tradition of having one of the movie songs sung by a popular singer. In this case, Celine Dion.
Yep. It was, I mean, and Celine Dion is big now, but if you didn't live through the early 90s, you know, late 80s, early 90s, you have no idea how big Celine Dion was. I mean, she was everywhere. Everywhere.
I do love, I mean, people say, oh, this started with Disney doing this, and it really, no, because you have, the only other time I'd heard this thing happen would be in, American Tale, with Somewhere Out There with, Linda Ronstadt and, Luther Vandross. And I think that was the first that I know of that thing happened.
But not a Disney movie.
Yeah, not a Disney
I
movie,
mean,
so.
this was very much, and yes, I do believe that they were absolutely trying to capitalize on the success of Somewhere Out There, which was a massive hit. That came just before this, right? That was late.
About
That
a
was late 80s.
few years prior, yeah, a few years
Yeah.
prior.
So I can absolutely believe, because even the way the song is styled, and getting Celine Dion, who had a very similar vocal range at the time to Linda Ronstadt, and also Peabo Bryson, to do the kind of duet part, which really shouldn't happen in Beauty and the Beast. It's very much a solo song. They were very definitely trying to do that same feeling. And then it just, the way things do with Disney, it kind of avalanched into its own unstoppable force.
And a thing that still continues today, like I said, Frozen 2, you've got songs from the movie sung by Panic at the Disco and Weezer.
Yeah, which is, I mean, I like both those bands. I'm not knocking the bands, but like, wow,
Who would ever thought you would ever hear Weezer in a Disney movie?
yeah, that's not a thing that should maybe happen. And of course, the kind of post credits stinger, unfortunately, for Beauty and the Beast. The very end of the movie reads, "To our friend Howard, who gave a mermaid her voice and a beast his soul, we will be forever grateful." And it ends with Howard Ashman, born 1950, died 1991. Howard Ashman did not live to see Beauty and the Beast finalized. He died while they were still in production.
Well, he's also started production on Aladdin as well.
He had started, I mean, they do still to this day, they run several movies kind of concurrently among
Yeah.
different teams. But yeah, he never saw a finalized version of Beauty and the Beast, not even kind of an early cut, I don't think. He found out about halfway through production of The Little Mermaid that he had AIDS. Today we have a lot of medications and stuff that weren't present in at the time. AIDS could be a very, very fast-moving disease at the time, and it was in the case of Howard Ashman. I think that was like 3 or 4 years or something, and he only told Alan Menken during the night of the Academy Awards that they went to for Little Mermaid. After the Academy Awards, he revealed to Menken that he had been diagnosed. Let's see, according to Wikipedia, they say he was diagnosed in 88. So he was diagnosed in 88. He died in 91. It turns out that he did survive through the time of the first screening, not the premiere, but the first early screening. But he was already in the hospital, could not see, could barely speak, and was in extremely poor health. So he never. He never made it there. He was 40 years old.
Gone too soon. I mean, especially with all the work you did.
Absolutely, absolutely gone too soon. I mean, just look at the kind of relatively small amount of work he left behind, and how absolutely impactful he was on the culture as a whole.
He, you know, not only in becoming, you know, not only in gay culture, but in musical culture, in Disney culture, you know, the modern Disney movie is based off the formula that he created for Little Mermaid and for Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, I mean, he absolutely did set the standard for Disney that they are still following today, in a lot of ways, big and small. So yeah, I mean, Howard Ashman, we miss you, and we really, really wish that you had gotten to be with us longer, because boy, we could have used that. That could have brought so much joy to the world. But boy, am I thankful for what we got.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely.
So I think that will be an episode.
Yes, episode two in the
Episode two.
can.
So the question goes, episode three?
Episode three. I mean, I think we've gotta keep going. I think we gotta keep going with Aladdin. You know, the talking about the Disney Renaissance, the Disney kind of fan wiki calls this, and possibly internally, this Beauty and the Beast is known as the third movie of the Disney Renaissance.
Yeah, we talked about that before with the Rescuers Down Under. Yeah.
Yeah. However, I do not think that that really is accurate. If you're talking about culturally important films, Rescuers Down Under is a great film. Do not get me wrong. I very much enjoyed it as a child. But it is not like the first thing you think of when you think Disney Renaissance.
It just happened to be released at the right time.
Yeah, it just happened. They had already been kind of working on it, and it just happened to be released around the same time, with a similar group of people. But when you think Disney Renaissance, you think Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Lion King. Those are the four you absolutely. That is the core of the Disney Renaissance. So I think we got to keep it going with Aladdin next time.
Yeah, I'm in full agreement. We will have an Arabian night. That's what I'm trying to get to. We'll have an Arabian night. Because you got to put the pun of the chorus song into the title here, into the format here. So
Yeah.
We're gonna go forward. We're gonna do Aladdin next. Again, if thank you all for downloading this thing. Thank you all for being part of this with us. Thank you guys for supporting us. We're just two nerds who just want to talk Disney movies, and you guys want to listen to us, and we will do this for as long as you guys want to listen to us. Straight
And
up.
absolutely, please contact us through any of our social media. Let us know what you're thinking about the show. Let us know if you've got any requests for the future, or you just want to, give us feedback on something we said. You know, we would absolutely love to hear from you.
Yeah. Keep this thing. We wanna form a community with you guys. Again, if there's a movie you think you want us to talk about, let us know. If you
Not even
disagree,
a movie. If there's a short you want us to watch, if there's
a
a,
series.
a series, a documentary, if it's in the Disney canon, it's kind of open.
If we can watch it on Disney Plus, we'll talk about
Yeah,
it.
right now, if we can watch it on Disney Plus,
Because that's the main thing. We want to be convenient, and right now Disney Plus is convenient.
Yeah.
10 million people have Disney Plus right now, so odds are, if you don't have Disney Plus, you know someone that does. So we want you guys to watch it with us. So watch
Yeah.
Aladdin sometime this week, and then come back here for the Aladdin episode, and well, we'll all talk about it. Simple
Yeah.
but we'll all talk about it. So, again, I think that's all I have to say about it. Is there anything else you need to say about Kiki?
No, it's absolutely this is just one of my favorite movies, and it, oh yeah, we didn't say, does it hold up as an adult? I think absolutely
Yes,
yes it does.
it does. It absolutely holds up
Super.
as it holds up.
Yeah, still as much fun to watch as an adult as it was as a kid.
Yeah,
So,
definitely, definitely. Is there anything else you want to say about the remake before we sign off?
don't let Emma Watson sing, please. I love Emma Watson. Please don't let her sing. She is a great, she is a feminist icon. I love her to death. She is an excellent actress. Please don't let her sing.
That was definitely, hiring for name value and not for vocal value.
Yeah. Stop with the stunt casting. Go back to like really good, core trained singers.
Oh,
and
we're
going
to talk stunt casting next week. Aladdin.
All right, spoilers.
So yeah. So again, everybody, if you downloaded this, obviously you're hearing us. But again, thank you for inviting us into your ears to talk about Disney stuff.
And now we will never leave.
Goodbye. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Rewatching the Magic. We invite you to keep the magic going by joining the conversation online. Find us on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic, on Twitter at Rewatch the Magic, and of course, find all new episodes at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Until next time, remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.